Good morning again, everyone. We're getting some more chairs out, so those will be up shortly so everyone can have a seat. And welcome to our annual Priest River, Priest Lake Lakes Commission meeting. We try to have at least one meeting over here every year. And given the space challenges we run into in Sandpoint, we may have more of them here. But for those of you who are not familiar with this facility, this was built with the generosity of the Buck Merritt family, including Buck and Carol Lee Merritt, the Jansons and the Lintons, who have made this facility, this beautiful facility available to us in Priest River. And I think we first want to thank them for having such a great place to have a public forum such as this, as well as other events. And I also want to thank the manager of the facility, Melanie Reddick, who's back behind the coffee, and thank her and Mayor and Carrie Martin, who have provided the catering for this morning. And if you're as impressed with the facility as I think you are and haven't been here before, and you want to schedule any weddings or maybe schedule your funeral and wake here, for if you're really a long-term estate planner, you can make arrangements with Melanie right back there, because she manages this facility. So thanks to the Merritt family for building us this beautiful facility. And maybe someday someone will put something this nice together in Sandpoint, but not losing any sleep over that. So we'll get going. A few other remarks I want to make before we get started. This is an open public meeting. We are an advisory board. We advise the governor and the legislature as to issues. We don't have any enforcement powers, but we have found that people listen to us, and you can see that by witnessing all the fantastic work that's about to begin on the Priest Lake on both the dam and the thoroughfare. But it is an open public meeting, but if there are any Florida State fans, we'd ask you to leave now. We cannot guarantee your safety. The second thing is, I think probably everyone here got the news. We tried to get it out as broad as possible. Approximately 4 weeks ago, a consulting firm on behalf of PacWest, the smelter developers in Newport, asked to be on our agenda today. In fact, one of the reasons we booked this facility was to make sure we would have enough room, because we anticipated a fairly large attendance as a result of having a presentation by PacWest. Late last week, we received notice from them, unfortunately, that they are declining to appear. They used as their excuse that because of the Pondre County Planning and Zoning Commission in Newport tabling their zoning motion, that somehow had something to do with the presentation to the Lakes Commission. I'm not really understanding that as a legitimate reason not to be here, but for anyone who didn't get the notice about the no-show by PacWest, I apologize if that's the reason you came today. We did try to get it out in the media and through the chamber and the Beacon and the Miner and so forth. But it's unfortunate because we had to move and reschedule a number of presentations and delay some to our summer meeting, and we wouldn't have had to do that. But we still have a packed agenda today, so we'll get underway. And so we'll begin shortly. These aren't rules, but we would really like it if you have a question. We'll take questions and comments as soon as each presentation is done. Usually we let the Lakes Commissioners ask the first questions. If you want to ask a question, I think the acoustics will be good enough to hear your question without providing the mic, but if that doesn't turn out to be the case, we'll bring the microphone to you. And please, when you do have a question or comment, please tell us who you are so we can get that down. We record these meetings and take notes, so we'd like to know if someone has a question or comment who you are. And so if you have a question at 9:30 and have another one at 11:30, we again ask you to please identify yourself during your second question so we get that on the record when we prepare the minutes. So with that, we're going to go ahead and get started. And the presenters, you're able to use, do like I'm doing now. If you want to maneuver the podium and use that instead, you're welcome to do so. And our first agenda item is...
Well, you might want to approve the minutes first.
Okay. Our first agenda item is to approve the minutes. Is there a motion to approve?
Sure.
Is there a second? Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Logan is first. I'm
going to
find out if she's in the audience.
Yeah. Is Logan here? Oh, there she is. Okay. Well, why don't we have Logan and her team get organized up front here for the Corps of Engineers, and we'll begin with her presentation with her crew and move on from there. So... I'll just let you get set up, Logan, and we're ready to go.
No, just got back last week.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Well, you picked a good time.
It dropped to 0 degrees.
I know. And it just got nice about a week ago. So. Okay. 2 weeks ago, I was driving through the worst blizzard I've ever driven through, just going from the Spokane airport to Moscow. You know, with the drifting down there.
I got 2 weeks in Switzerland to ski over there.
Did you?
Good
morning.
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys for having me. So I'm here to talk a little bit about Albany Falls operations for the spring and summer. And if anybody has any trouble hearing me, just kind of like wave at me. I've been told that it's sometimes hard to hear. My name is Logan Oskid-Zimmerman. I'm the senior water manager for Albany Falls. And let's get started. So I know a lot of you have seen this before, but in case not, this is our annual operating curve for Albany Falls Dam as measured at Hope on Lake Monterey. And so this bottom part, so this is over time starting in October, because we measure water years starting in October. And then on the x-axis is the elevation at Lake Monterey. And the bottom here is our minimum operating pool. And the top is the maximum that we can get to. As you can see, in some years, like last year, we go above that top because there's natural constriction. And at some points, there's only so much water you can get out of the lake, and so it rises above our maximum. And so we only operate in the top 11 feet of Lake Monterey, and that's about 1 million acre feet of storage there. And that is compared to most years, about an average inflow year. There's about, during our kind of refill season, which is April to July, there's about 12 million acre feet that comes into Lake Monterey. And our downstream, so our control point is at Hope, but downstream, there's a flood. The flood flow is 95,000. Cubic feet per second of water going through. And okay, so for what we're seeing for this year, the year I kind of see is split into two. So you have the part before January and the part starting in February. So in January, before January, so October to January, when you get moisture built up in the soil and you can start building snow, it was really dry here. This area in yellow is about the bottom 30% of years. But then in February, as I'm sure you all are very well aware, it started raining and snowing. A lot of snow here, and it was well above average. But then it hit March and just dried up again. And then tied to that is the temperature. Because if it's cold, we build snow, which will come off later in the season. But if it's warm, it falls as rain, which can run off much faster and earlier in the season. So from October through January, it was pretty warm, again, in that kind of top 30% of warm years for October through January. But then moving into February, it got really, really cold. I've heard that there's more ice on the lake and on the river than people have seen in a very, very long time. And then in March, it stayed pretty cold through most of March and just really recently started warming up and melting some of this low elevation snowpack that's around here. And so what that means is, in terms of snowpack, we're at about 87% of average. So that's a kind of low snowpack year. A lot of that snow actually is in that the upper Clark Fork area, so like around Butte in there. And then as you go down, there's less and less snow. Now, as I said before, we get inflows many times above the storage of Lake Condre, so the chance of not, there's not really a chance of not refilling, we would refill the lake. And then just kind of looking forward for what's coming, this is the climate outlooks. These are kind of the best we can do, but it's looking at climate indices, so we've been wrong many times. So looking forward, this is April through June. There's a above average chance of it being warm, and then about 50-50% chance for precipitation being above or below normal. So, in summary for kind of the weather and what we're looking at, the precipitation has been below average in general, and the temperature was below average through January and then really cold after that, which has helped build a little bit of snowpack for us. And right now the snowpack is about 87% of average, and that all told adds up to a water supply forecast. So for that refill season that I talked about for April through July, of 81% of average, and that's 9.5 million acre feet. So what this actually looks like for Lake Condre, right? Moving forward, this is, I'll talk about what we did first. So this is that same curve that I showed you before, and what the lake elevation actually has been. So we started the fall draft at September 18th, same as we've been doing for the last couple years. And then we finished the draft around November 14th before the kokanee started spawning. And while the kokanee are spawning, we operate in a half-foot operating band in that bottom part of the lake, 2051 to 2051.5. And then we got notification that the kokanee were done spawning December 21st, and that opened up that band. And we operate in this in the bottom 1 foot then. So if there's a request from BPA that we could do flexible winter power operations, there were no requests this year, so we stayed in that bottom 1 foot operating band the whole time. And then this is looking forward. So bottom, again, this is dates starting in October. And then on the y-axis, we have elevation at Lake Condre. And so the green dots are what's happened already. And then the blue coming up is the median kind of average of what we'd expect going forwards. And then the kind of 50th to 75th percentile of what might happen. And so we're going to start refilling in a few days here. And we're targeting 2055 at the end of April, and then targeting refill about mid-June. And so that's what we do on a year when we don't expect to go on free flow. So free flow is when we take all the gates out of Albany Falls Dam and just let whatever's coming through naturally go through. We do that on years when there's a really high water supply forecast to try to make sure that the lake doesn't go above flood stage. This year, because the water supply forecast is lower, we don't expect to need to do that, so we'll do a controlled refill. However, we can get those late season storms. We've had a couple times in the past up from the Gulf that can hit us, and we don't want to be forced to pass above flood flow for downstream. And so we target refill about mid-June. And this is a look at what the outflows will actually look like during that time. So it looks like we're expecting inflows to really start coming up a little bit in the next month, but really pick up in May and early June. And that's also part of why we target refill in mid-June, is because that peak is in early June. And so that way we can capture it kind of as it comes on. So this is the overview of what I said before. So our target for the end of April is 2055. If flows start coming out earlier, like they did last year, it gets really, really warm, and a lot more water starts coming in, we might end up a little bit higher than that. And then our refill target above 2062 is in mid-June. And again, that kind of depends on the shape of the runoff. So if it's a really early runoff and we see that snow is, you know, going to be gone super early, we might end up refilling a little bit earlier. But if you see big storms coming or it starts just raining, we might push it back a little bit. And so right now, we have a current snowpack. The flood risk this year is pretty low. There is always that chance of the rain and storms just coming in again and again. And if that does happen, things can change. But with the snowpack, it's pretty low. And we do have a public meeting that's coming up on April 24th. We'll be back here and talking about what we see. By the end of April, we have a much better idea of what the runoff looks like. And so we can update on what's happening.
I'm not sure if I can make it.
And then, if you have any questions, you can do questions now, but also if you want to ask questions later, these are two emails of mine, and then also just the general water management contact information that someone will always get back to. Open up to questions.
Laura, we'll try without the mics out here, so I'll start. How does, it seems like just from some of the snowpack maps, including yours that I've seen, that the snowpack south of us is at 150% of normal. How does that affect the whole Columbia Basin, in other words? Is that just going to mean that reservoirs will finally fill down there, or will it actually impact? I just was wondering if they feel that will cover the fish free flow. The fish flow is what I'm asking about. It seems like there is ample water south of south of this basin when you get into the Clearwater and the Snake and so forth. So. How does that impact, if at all, core operations up in this region?
So, first of all, for the Columbia, their water supply forecast is a little below average, but not nearly as much as ours because of that water down there. And it really shouldn't impact our operations at all. We do most of what we do to support the lower Columbia is built into our operations. And so, we don't get very many requests, especially on the refill side, for operations for the lower Columbia. So especially in a year when we have less water than the lower river, I wouldn't expect it to impact our operations.
Okay. Questions from commissioners? Questions from the audience here? Questions from the public? Any questions for the Corps today? Well, you're getting up pretty easy.
Okay.
I have a couple more for you. First of all, you can get a regular email on the lake level just by signing up by going to one of these addresses, right?
Yeah. If you email, either one of those email addresses and ask to be added, we'll add you. It usually takes like a week or so to get it.
And then you get a daily email on flow and so forth.
Every time there's a change above 2,000 cubic feet per second.
Okay. And then it didn't look like there was, I know John from the BPA is here, but it didn't look like there was any attempt, and maybe it was because of work on the Delta, I'm not sure, but there wasn't any attempt on the interim, whatever that's called, the interim raise and lowering for power generation was not meaningful again this year. Is that sort of faded from view, given that the demand that time of year hasn't been that strong anyway?
No, actually the demand was really high this year. I think they wish they had stored something. They had it stored and then they can't draw down below where we are. So they actually used it last year a couple of times. So it has been used. This year they would have, I was told they would have done a request if there was drum gate maintenance at Cooley, but it was not a drum gate maintenance this year, and so they ended up not needing it to support that. So it wasn't used this year. But I far as I know, it's not leaking.
And I know this is not directly related to spring, summer, and fall flow, but I'm just wondering now that the overall settlement has been reached with BPA on mitigation, and that presumably means there's going to continue to be major work to stop erosion, not only in the Delta, but I'm assuming elsewhere around the lake, like the Corps has been doing. Will that pretty much keep the winter at a low level for the foreseeable future to allow that work to take place?
You know, I don't know what work is planned at this point. I'll look out if John or Tony know more than I do. Usually I don't find out until kind of as they're making the plans and figuring out exactly where they're going to need to be. So at this point, I don't know. We're planning to keep with the same low level so we can do the flip over across them.
Okay, well, if there are any, oh, here we do have a question.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering how much cooperation.
Sorry. Go ahead. You might want to start over.
The upriver dams and the downriver dams, how much cooperation during the flood stages goes on during that time? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. There's a lot of talk back and forth. We regularly have kind of weekly check-ins with Bureau with Country Course upstream, and then if it's during flood season, people are calling back and forth all the time just to check in and see what you'll need and coordinate with the regional area as well. But it's kind of an as needed in flood season. If it's flooding, it will be probably every couple days. Yeah.
Any other questions for the Corps before we move on to Hungry Horse? Well, thank you. You got off easy, Laura, so if you want to hand it off to Joel, I think he's going to talk with us about our next item, everybody, is Hungry Horse Dam operations and why that's relevant to us. Joel will explain to you, and I think you're all familiar with Joel. He's been coming over and speaking for the Corps on many occasions to us. So with that, Joel, take it away.
Hey, thanks. It's good to be back here. Haven't been back here since June of last year, and usually came up here a lot, so it's kind of nice to drive around and not have to think about the lake as work. It's just kind of like this pretty body of water that I can kind of enjoy now visually. Instead of thinking about what the level is and what the concerns are and stuff like that. So I moved over about a year ago to the Bureau of Reclamation in Boise. So one of the dams I'll be overseeing my group is Hungry Horse, which is upstream of Albany Falls, Lake Pend'Oreille, up in western Montana. So I'm going to go through just the general operations, basically hydrology, how it affects things in terms of the base, in terms of the overall Pend'Oreille Basin, basically what its requirements and how it's operated on. Give a brief projection on where we're sitting in terms of snowpack and water supply and operations this year, and then I'll kind of go through what happened last year in terms of operations too, because I think there was some concern about how Hungry Horse operations went last year given the high May, so we'll get into that a little bit here too. So first thing is Hungry Horse is up here in western Montana, feels like Pend'Oreille. It is part of the Federal Columbia River power system. It's a reclamation dam, but it still feeds into the grid that and the power system that BPA monitors. It's up here on the south fork of the Flathead, and it feeds directly into Flathead Lake, or I don't want to say it, but abbreviated SKG Dam. I can't pronounce it anymore. They changed it from GERD to SKG. So I'm not going to try to pronounce that. I did once, so it was amazing. But overall, here's the total Pend'Oreille watershed. So here's Horse again, South Fork. There's the Middle Fork and North Fork of the Flathead that come in at the same time, so it's kind of like in this triple confluence of rivers. It only really has control over about 1,600 square miles of the watershed. Down to Albany Falls, there's about 20,000 square miles of the basin. A lot of it's unregulated in the Clark Fork. We have Como, which is a small irrigation dam up here, but that's it in terms of, I mean, it's drop in the bucket, literally, of water. So Hungry Horse only really has capacity to control about 8% of the total Ponderay Basin up here. And it usually takes somewhere between, you know, 2 weeks to a month for the water that's being released and going through Horse to come out of Lake Ponderay, or to come all the way through the Ponderay system and into Coulee. So in terms of like actual amounts of water that Horse has control over, just to give perspective, there's on average about 11 to 12 million acre feet that come into Lake Ponderay unregulated. Of that, there's 27% comes from the Clark Fork, which is the southern part of western Montana here. There's another 53% that comes from the Flathead. In total, that includes Flathead Lake and the Three Forks up here. But then in terms of what's the actual inflow that would be coming through the Ponderay system if Horse wasn't there, that's only about 15% of the total water generated. So there's not a lot of control in terms of trying to augment inflows into Lake Ponderay down at this point, just because it's so overwhelmed by these two other forks, which are about the same size in terms of like water quantity coming through. So a little bit more about Hungry Horse Dam. It's got about 200 feet of capacity in terms of active capacity. It's much larger than that. It's about 350 feet tall. It's got four power generation units that have a capacity of 408 megawatts. So in perspective, Albany Falls, I think, has about 45 megawatts in max capacity, releasing about triple what Horse's capacity can do. So it's a much higher head dam and produces a lot more power with a little bit of a lot less water. But we are limited to only being able to use 3 units, just basically due to a restriction of the power lines between Libby and Hungry Horse. This is a byproduct of the aluminum smelters going out from the Flathead Valley. So generally, if Libby, which is the Horse Dam in western Montana, and Horse are going at full power, we generally have to back off our power generation to not blow up the transmission lines up there. Primary uses are hydropower. It's got flood risk management objectives, both for the lower Columbia River system and also locally at Columbia Falls, which is just downstream of the dam. We also have fish and wildlife requirements in terms of minimum flows just downstream at both the dam and at Columbia Falls, and I'll get into that a little bit more. And then also for some water augmentation that goes through the Columbia River system through the summer. And a little bit of recreation too during the summer when we fill it. So basically, like I said, we already have this part, but the main thing we usually try to do in terms of flood risk is control the flow of Columbia Falls, which is right here, of course it's here, but we only control 1/3 of the water that's coming through Columbia Falls. So like this last year, we were releasing about 6,000 CFS and had to keep reducing releases not to have Columbia Falls go over the flood stage, and there was about 15,000 CFS coming through Columbia Falls. So there's a lot of water that can be generated going into Flathead Lake. For fish and wildlife, we have minimum flows at Columbia Falls of 3,200 to 3,500 CFS. That's been mainly what's been controlling so far this winter. And during the summer, we draft the lake 10 to 20 feet from full, and that's to provide water for the lower Columbia system for salmon out migration. So basically, a typical operation during the winter months, like this month or this year, we've been operating at the Columbia Falls minimum, and that's been pulling the dam down because the inflows have been less than what we've had to release in order to maintain the flows of Columbia Falls. Or we're pulling the lake down starting in January through April to try to keep enough space to refill the reservoir safely for dam safety purposes, but also to try to have enough capacity to reduce releases in case we're going to see flooding on Columbia Falls. During the spring months, we're usually maintaining a flow release that just is kind of guides how the reservoir is filled. And then we try to generally refill the reservoir at the end of June. And during the summer, then we're coordinating with the technical management team down in Portland to release water throughout the summer to get the lake down from 10 to 20 feet per pool. So that's the general operation throughout the year. So switching over to this year, our current water supply forecast is 93% of average. We do these forecasts once a month at the beginning of the month, so we're about to do another series of forecasts next week. So we're expecting that with how dry March has been, and luckily we've held onto our snowpack so far just because it's been so cold, but that will probably go down to probably like 80 to 90% of average, which doesn't really mean too much in terms of reservoir operations. And like Logan pointed out, we're seeing, you know, fairly low snowpacks out in western Montana, so about 84% of average. So what that means in terms of operations, we'll just kind of go through this. So anything before this line is something we've already seen this year, and then what's after this line is what we're projecting. So this is just an inflow trace, which is this orange line right here. That's the inflow we expect to see in the Hungry Horse Dam. This dark blue line is what we're releasing. This is what's coming through at Columbia Falls. And then this green line up here is the actual reservoir pore bay elevation. So most of the winter we've been operating just to keep Columbia Falls at its minimum flow around 3,500 CFS. Because that's been higher than what we've been getting into the reservoir. It's just been drafting down. Probably are hitting our bottom right now as the inflows are starting to pick up and turn around. And then we'll start refilling the reservoir in probably, throughout April and May, and then reach the peak. The flood flow at Columbia Falls is about 51,000 CFS usually. It changes depending on how high the flat of the lake goes, so we're not really seeing too much of a flood threat this year. So, compared to last year, which is a totally different story, we saw the third highest snowpack, I think, since 1981 in the Flathead Basin. And many stream flows throughout the entire Conroe Basin, just went through it yesterday, were pretty much record totals from there. So for Hungry Horse, we got in about 1,500,000 acre feet. That's a double the May average. It was the highest May we've seen since, I think, the 1950s or 40s. So it was a pretty phenomenal year in terms of, like, runoff and stream flows. one of the major considerations, I'll get into this a little bit, was that we had a lot of the generation units out. And when you have generation units out and you have a big water year, you're going to be spilling a lot. And then what happens when you spill is you start generating gas. And the gas can give the fish the bends and stuff like that. So we're trying to minimize how much we were going to spill throughout the spring just because we were limited on powerhouse. And given how big of a year it was going to be, we wanted to have the reservoir down a little bit lower than what we were required to have it down to. So here's the snowfill site. Sorry, it's a little small, but this red line is the snow last year at Noisy Basin. And this is, the dark lines are basically statistics that I told them I wasn't going to do statistics, I lied. This is the 50th percentile, the 90th percentile, and the 10th. And so we were well above just the normal range in terms of snowpack here at Noisy Basin. And these are 97 and 2011. So these were probably the last 2 years where you guys saw significant flooding on Lake Pundray. So we were pretty much seeing. Yeah, and it ended up being also the third largest year in terms of total inflow through the basin since 1981. And so with that meant in terms of snowpack, if you look over here just at the percent average, don't look at our forecast. You know, basically January and February we're looking at about 120% average snowpack. That's big, but it's not anything you get too worried about. In February, we got a lot of precipitation. It was cold up there. Snowpack built up to about 140% of average. March was it built a little bit, and it lost a little bit of the percent of average, but we generally kept up with where it was, and then May, in April, it really took off. So that drove our forecast up. And this forecast, just is basically guiding how we draw the reservoir down through the ledger. And so if you're sitting out here in January or February and you're at 120%, you're going to hit a target. But what the guide curve essentially does is it tries to balance like how much we need for flood control and still rebuild the reservoir. So even though we're seeing, you know, fairly healthy snowpack, we weren't like at a point where we just wanted to plunge the reservoir down until we got to February and March. And our forecast actually performed fairly well. This is about 2.5 MAP, so the total inflow volume between May through September was 150% average. So our forecast started picking up on this as the snow was building fairly significantly through the winter, but we only started catching up into it, really up to it until about April. So, thin graph is last time, this green or gray line is the reservoir floor bay elevation. So, a little different is this yellow line is where we were required to be at the end of each month. And so, January and February, we were well below where we were required to be. But as the snowpack started to build in February, my staff started releasing more water to start getting it down, so we hit our March targets. And by the time we got to the end of April, and that's usually when we'll see the freshet really come on, we were 5 feet below where we were required to be. So that was in consideration of how many generation units we got out. So this dark blue line is what we were releasing, and this is Columbia Falls. So once we got into the spring, we dropped releases as the freshet was really starting to come on in those other two forks of the flathead. We started releasing about 6,000 CFS, but all these little drops here, those were to try to keep Columbia Falls below 51,000 CFS so it didn't flood the farmlands right there. So this is, we were expecting this. Luckily, this came off in just some like little pushes in terms of heat. Luckily, we didn't get any like real big spring rains in May that would really push us down and build up the reservoir for a lot faster. So that's why our forest came down quickly and we were releasing a lot of water in February because we were trying to get the reservoir down prior to the spring freshet. So that's all I had. So questions?
Questions for Joel on Hungry Horse.
I have a question.
Sure.
So this line before that you were talking about the average?
Yeah. So that's usually based off of the record we have from 1981 to 2010.
81?
Yes, so after 2020, we'll update all those averages again.
Okay.
So we keep them stable for 10 years just as a reference point. So I would expect some of these averages, this last decade's been interesting, so I expect a lot of these averages to probably pop up a little bit more in terms of water supply.
That's a lot of technical data. And I'm a fly fisherman, and I spend not as much of time as in the past, but I spend enough time in these various rivers of the year. So my question is very simple as far as averages. You're having, you don't anticipate any nitrogen buildups at the flow rates that you've got now because of the snowpack, because that's at less than maximum.
The nitrogen buildup?
Right.
In terms of flooding the river?
Well, as far as the fish.
As far as the fish?
I heard you say something about it. So
that's the gas levels.
Right.
So that's basically the pressurized bubbles that happen when we spill again. So we're not looking at spilling this year like we did last year.
Okay. So getting back to the averages, we anticipate fairly average year, so getting on the river, there's not going to be any. Don't anticipate any floods to speak of.
Not at this point. Like Logan said, like I said for the last 10 years before when I was presenting to you guys about all my falls, it really depends on how late May and June play out in terms of precipitation. But as far as the current snowpack is, I don't want to anticipate flood.
You know, so there's a tremendous amount of ice. Last Monday I was up to Libby Dam, and I was impressed at the depth of the ice and as far upstream as it's going. The temperatures were pretty mild there. I mean, I should have been on the water.
Yeah.
I was wondering if the South Fork is going to be pretty persistent.
In terms of temperatures or in terms of
flows?
In terms of flows, yeah, we should be seeing actually below average flows this year. Yes, sir.
Is Hungry Horse a top release or bottom release dam? So during the summer water releases, are you releasing warmer water or colder water?
That's a very interesting question. So we do have, it's a bottom release through the three outlet tubes and the powerhouse. And we actually have a selective withdrawal system where we put in gates to control the temperature that's coming out of the dam. Now, once we get into the top 12 feet, we do have a glory hole spillway, which will take water off the top, but that's only generally used for emergency. So that's that, I don't know if you guys remember, but 10 slides back, what we were saying, we have about 50,000 CFS of spillway capacity, that would be the glory hole spillway. But that's rarely ever used. It might get like a couple CFS coming through during when we get top off the reservoir just because it's sitting there and it's sucking in a little bit of water, but usually most of the water comes out of the bottom.
So what's the temperature of the release during summer release?
I don't know off the top of my head. Usually, I think they try to target, and this is totally off the top of my head, it's probably somewhere between like 40 to 50 degrees maybe for the trout, but I'm referring back to my Libby DM days in Western Montana right now.
Sure. So, if I understand you correctly, you said the releases are based on information from the Columbia. Well, talk to me about how you get that information and what that entails.
Okay, let me go back. So, basically,
Joel, will you repeat the question?
Just so, he's asking how we coordinate and basically what the summer operation is in terms of kind of 10 to 20 feet per pole. That's what you're. You're referring to the summer operation, how it's coordinated?
Right.
Okay. So this is a summer draft where here's 3560, that's our full pool. So this year, we're right now we're right on the borderline before the cutoff. And so this will get to your question. So this, whether we draft 10 feet or 20 feet from full is based off of the water supply forecast on the lower Columbia River system at the Dalles. And so that gets below the 20th percentile projection in terms of water supply, which is really on the border right now. If it goes below that, this will turn into a 20 feet draft and we'll be releasing a lot more water through the summer. And so once that forecast comes out in May, so we'll know that in about 5 weeks, what the draft target's gonna be for horse. We'll start discussing that with the technical management team in Portland, and that's the group of the federal agencies, NOAA Fisheries, Fish and Wildlife Service, the Corps Reclamation, EPA, four states, and the tribes overseeing the biop operations on the Columbia River system. But it's all based off of the water supply forecast that comes out of the lower Columbia River system. Does that get to your question? Okay.
Question?
Yes.
You indicated that your flood control operations are targeted to prevent flooding at Columbia Falls. Mm-hmm. Is there any consideration given to flood control of the whole system, or is it just focused on what's going to happen at Columbia Falls?
So he's asking, so I spent a lot of time talking about flood risk on Columbia Falls. So he's asking, you know, how does this tie into the bigger overall system? So Hungry Horse, like Libby Dam, the other dam in Western Montana that Logan has now, it's a barque operation. So basically there's a requirement of flow down here based off of how far you've drafted the reservoir. Hungry Horse has a little bit more flexibility than Libby does. You can choose a flow lower than if you wanted to. But basically, for the Columbia River system in the Pend Oreille, this right here, this volume that's coming off, that bulk volume, so it's a controlled flow, so we're supposed to set the flow at a certain point. So this last year, we were targeting about 6,000 CFS. So anything above that essentially is counted towards helping out the lower Pend Oreille and Columbia River system in terms of capturing this bulk of water, this orange line above the what we were releasing with our blue lines. So this ended up being about, I think, 1.6 million acre feet. So that's about 1.25 Albany Falls of active capacity. So that's where it comes in. We don't have, you know, because the travel time is so long, we have limited part of the basin that we can control the flows in. You know, it's just kind of like setting up the operation and scheming up the inflows that help out the lower part of the river. So it's not like we can be like, hey, Albany Falls is going to go above 2062.5, can you cut back? You know, by the time that's going to happen, we're already cutting back releases and we're doing what we can for the lower part of the river. Yes, ma'am.
So I'm wondering what the risk would be of drafting farther or deeper, however you say it, in the wintertime. You mentioned that you have a target that you have to hit and you went below that. But what's the real risk of not actually filling enough in the summertime?
It would be providing minimum flows throughout the summertime or in the summer augmentation water that's required. And it also would mean we would have less of a chance of maintaining the flow of Columbia Falls. So if we drafted lower and we didn't refill the reservoir, then we wouldn't have as much water coming through the system later on in the summer for fishery purposes.
Do you really use the full amount in the reservoir? Or when you say you're drafting it to a certain point, is there more available? I mean, are you really drafting all the way like we do here?
No. But it's a totally different operation in that you guys have 1 million acre feet of capacity, usually 12, so you can refill the reservoir 12 times over. The active capacity here, the 3 million acre feet, the average inflow of the Hungry Horse is actually about 2.7 million acre feet. So it would be a very rare occasion, like last year, 2018, 2011, and 96 and 97, where we potentially be targeting having the lake completely empty. So it depends on where our water supply is. It's not a guarantee that we're going to go down to that level every single year.
Sorry. One follow up to that. Has there been a history of not refilling enough in the summertime? Even like in 2015, say, when there was a drought?
Yeah, it's been harder on the headwater projects, like of course in Living in Western Montana. Sorry, I'm talking about the Gorge project right now, but he's never seen it. But Hungry Horse has had the same problem as Living the last couple of years. Like in 2017, we had that big snowpack and the big buildup, but then basically we hit like May, and all the way through the summer we didn't get rain for 90 days. We didn't refill the reservoir, even though we had a large snowpack. 2015 was another refill year, missed year, just because it was a warm winter and all the water kept coming through the Monterey system. So yeah, there is a definite risk to overdrafting the reservoir and not having enough water in it.
Okay.
So was there a recreation component on that reservoir?
Yeah, it's to refill it and then basically hold it up. But yeah, like I said, we generally try to drop the lake down 10 feet from the pool every single year.
And how
it's
how
pretty small. It's not anything like you guys have in terms of like boats, you know, using the lake here.
How do they deal with elevation changes of 20 feet?
I'm not sure about 20 feet. A lot of them, the 10 feet from full, I'm not sure how many boat ramps that are really up on Horse, but usually a lot of the maintenance on that reservoir is even like on Cooley built down into it in terms of having the beaches and having the boat ramps accessible to those lower elevations. Because Cooley, Marion Cooley, which is downstream of Albany Falls, it's got draft targets too to be 12 feet from full at the end of August. And they actually, it's kind of different than here, they actually don't want us to be within 5 feet of full because that starts inundating a lot of the recreational beaches. So it's a different paradigm than Lake Monterey where you want to have it up for 90 or 100 years. So. Yes?
So you made a list of all the priorities of the dam. So power generation and recreation, as you talked about. Fisheries. What's the priority? Like in a drought year, like you were just talking about, or what's this? There's got to be a priority of ABCD.
Right. Yeah. You know, the talking point is all authorized uses. generally doesn't necessarily just play out that way. So I'll talk about it in terms of the time. So in terms of coordination, I'd say endangered species takes the most. Sorry about that. Endangered species takes the most, and then flood risk is second. Power generation is kind of an ancillary of the other two. So we're usually not like, it's not like with Grand Coulee, which is one of the other dams my group oversees, but it's like, you know, like last month in February when we're seeing all the high power prices, they're like, we want to draft this thing. Basically, like, of course, the power generation is a secondary, comes out secondarily after those, even though it's on par in theory with those two. It's just kind of like a side thing that we coordinate with Bonneville Power Administration. And then recreation would be the lowest, just in terms of it, just in terms of trying to get it refilled by June and having the lake propped up through a good part of the summer if we can. So it really comes down to more of a time thing in how I go through my daily job in terms of what gets most of my attention.
Other questions?
I do have one more question.
Okay.
At the beginning, you talked about 12 million acre feet of unregulated flows coming into the Ponderay, I believe.
Uh-huh.
And then you had, I believe that 15% was from the Flathead there, or the South Fork of the Flathead.
Right.
Either way, I guess my question is, what percentage, what acre feet is coming in from regulated flows? So that you said that the 12 million was unregulated. Is a portion of that regulated?
Yeah, so I pulled this from the RFC, so this is their natural inflows. They have another forecast, water supply forecast, which has the regulated flow, and usually that's about 10.5-11 million acre feet coming into Lake Ponderay.
Of regulated? Okay. Thank you.
Okay, we have a couple of minutes left on this presentation. Is there any other questions for Joel on Hungry Horse? Thank you, Joel, very much. Appreciate the presentation. So the next three items, as you all can see, is involving fish and game issues, both on Priest and Ponderay. And we're going to start off with Priest and Upper Priest Fisheries Management with Andy Dux, and he will take it from here, first starting off on Priest and Upper Priest Lake, and then later on this morning he'll be moving into the walleye situation in Ponderay.
All right, well, thanks for the opportunity to be here. We are going to make one adjustment. I asked Molly, and she said this would be okay, but we're going to switch the order of our first two presentations. I think it's going to be a little more logical flow. We'll start with the walleye presentation that relates to Ponderay, and then we'll transition into some Priest Lake stuff, which will then allow us to follow with the third presentation that also relates to Priest Lake. And then the other thing we're going to do is so I'm Andy Dux, the regional fish manager, And I put my name on the agenda a long time ago with Molly, but we have this new program that we would like to get out in front of everybody that relates to a walleye angler incentive program, consistent with some of the work we're doing to try to manage the threat that walleye are posing to the Lake Ponderay fishery. And so what I've done, though, is asked one of my staff, Ken Bowens, to give this presentation. He's been heavily involved in launching this new program, so we'll both be here and help with questions, but I'm going to ask Ken to run through a summary of this new program we're rolling out.
Hi there. Yeah, so as Andy said, my name is Ken Bowens. I'm a fishery biologist with the Idaho Department of Fish and Game, and I work with the Avista Mitigation Program. And so my job basically is to implement the aquatic fisheries programs with the Clark Fork Settlement Agreement for the Idaho Department of Fish and Game. So we're here today to talk about walleye. Well, I'm here for a little while to talk about walleye. Basically, they were originally introduced illegally into the Moxon Reservoir in 1991. Where's the pointer thing?
Right above the advance, the arrows.
Gotcha.
Green.
I'm messing all this up.
It's hard to find. Oh, that's it. Here, I'll.
Okay, I found it. Sorry about that. So, while we were illegally introduced into the Knox and Reservoir in 1991, they've made their way downstream through the dams and down into Ponderay and into the Ponderay River. I think it was in 2005 or 6 we first documented them in the river downstream of Sandpoint, in the Ponderay River. And I guess the big question is what's the big deal about walleye? We have other species that are not native in the lake, and why is walleye such a threat? And so that's what I'm here to talk to you about a little bit right now. So the big thing with walleye is they're ferocious predators. They eat like crazy, and they do pose a threat to our fishery because of that. One of the reasons why they're such big predators is because they're fast growing fish. They can pack on the groceries and they can put it into fish bodies very quickly. And that's something that is a threat to our fishery. The third part of the threat is that they've got a very high reproductive potential. Walleye will produce about 30,000 eggs per pound for females. So they can lay out a lot of eggs very quickly. And they're fast growing and they can reproduce very quickly. So they have the ability to take and invade an ecosystem that they're not normally in very, very fast. So what I want to do is talk to you a little bit about what we know about walleye. So we do a survey, it's called the FWIN survey, Fall Walleye Index Netting, and that survey is based on random netting that we do around Lake Ponderay and in the river. They're relatively small gill nets, but they're variable mesh, so they collect and they capture fish of all different sizes. And they're based on a survey that was originally designed back in walleye land, you know, to the east of us. And they've been found to provide a pretty good indication of relative abundance. We don't have a number of how many fish are out there, but we do have an idea of what the population's doing relative to what it did a couple years ago. So our survey, first one we did was in 2011. We did them every 3 years. And the take-home message from this is about every 3 years, the population of walleye has been doubling in the lake. And that's extremely alarming to us. And the part that's the most alarming is the doubling. Not the absolute abundance we still think is relatively low, but their ability to reproduce quickly is what's concerning. So does this sound familiar to anybody as far as what's gone on in the past with lake trout? I think the threats are very much the same between walleye and lake trout. You know, obviously, we implemented the lake trout suppression program in 2006, and it was a two-pronged approach between netting and an angler incentive program. So where we're at right now is we're recognizing that there's that threat to our fishery, and we're trying to implement a pilot program to see if it's the things that we did with lake trout may potentially work also with walleye. So the best metric I have to provide to you on what might happen with the walleye suppression in our pilot suppression program is what happened with lake trout. And I think the important part of this is the fact that if you look at it over the years, the angling pressure that we use through incentivized angling has been a very significant part of the number of lake trout that have been removed from the program. And we're hoping that the similar thing would be possible with walleye. So with lake trout, you know, if most of you are probably familiar, there's a $15 head bounty on lake trout. And there are some issues that would probably prevent that from being at least our initial look at how doing incentivized angling with walleye would be. The first issue is the fiscal uncertainty of not really knowing exactly how many walleyes would be turned in for an incentive program. You know, at this point, where it's a new fishery, we don't understand it very well. So it's kind of a risk to just say we're going to pay so much per head and open that up, because we don't really know how much money that would cost us. The other problem would be potential for non-Pongray walleye to be turned into the program. One of the things with lake trout is there was, when we implemented the lake trout program, is there was very few lake trout sources close. So there was relatively low risk of people bringing fish in from other places and submitting them to the program. With walleye, that's not the case so much. You know, the club, there's a, like I said earlier, there's established populations in the Clark Fork River upstream of Cabinet Gorge in Montana. That Montana's not participating in this program, and then there's also obviously walleye downstream of us. So there's the potential for people bringing in heads and trying to cheat the system is higher with walleye than it was with lake trout. So just as an initial way to get started with this, we proposed a different strategy to do it. The first one is that we have a tagged fish. We have tagged fish out there. So the big money fish are not, we know came from Lake Pondere because we put them there. There's 51 fish that we tagged with a very small microscopic tag in the snout of these fish. Anglers won't know whether the fish that they catch are tagged or not. However, when those fish heads are submitted to the program, then we can tell, and then those fish are worth $1,000 a piece. So the big money fish are out there, and we know that people have to fish Pongaree to get them. So that's, but then there's also the side of, well, what if, is that enough to really keep people engaged? So beyond the $1,000 fish, we also have 10 $100 drawings a month. So the rest of the heads that can get turned in that don't have the big money tags associated with them then are eligible for a drawing for $100 to keep people interested. So this program, as I said earlier, is only in effect for the Pongaree watershed within the state of Idaho. We also are interested in fish coming from not just the lake and the Pongaree River and the Clark Fork River, but if any come out of Priest River or Pack River or places like that. So that leads me to the data slip that we have, that if anybody has been participating, it's a little different than with the new program than we had with the lake trout. And the reason why is we're trying to collect a little bit more information with the walleye than we are getting from the lake trout program. The first thing is the location where the fish are caught. That's something that hasn't been as well. We didn't flesh that out as well as we could have in the past. So, you know, on the slip, there's the normal, you know, demography type questions. And then we're trying to get an idea of both timing, the month that the fish were caught, and then the locations where the fish were caught. So hopefully these slips will provide a little bit more information and help us understand the fishery a little bit more. The other thing that we've done is we've increased a few more freezers than we had with the lake trout program. We brought freezers in at North 40 at Pondere and Arnie's Conoco in Kootenai, and then also Peck's Landscape Supply on in Sagal, and the last freezer location that's new is we have one at the Bruce River Boat Ramp down here too. So that's what I have on this program. I'll turn it back to Andy, and I think we'll do questions at the end, or I don't know how we want to do that. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
The fish that you tag, are they sterile?
No, it doesn't have anything to do with that. No, these tags were just put in the snout of just the fish that were large, and there's been no sterile fish or anything like that added to the lake.
So the fish that you're putting back in could be reproducing?
They could be. Go ahead, go back.
Okay, we spoke of 30,000 eggs per rough question because you're throwing your best educated guess, and that's all I got.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what survival on those eggs are. I mean, obviously, when you have a whole bunch of eggs coming from a species, the assumption is most of them don't survive, and fish that have larger eggs, you know, have a higher survival rate on their eggs. You know, that's one thing that we're trying to get a handle on with these fish is what our recruitment is, what our survival is, and those things like that. We're very much just right at the very beginning of trying to understand how this population is starting to develop in the system. So, one of the things that is an issue that I forgot to mention earlier is after these eggs hatch with walleye, very quickly after they hatch, the larvae became pelagic, and they actually drift with the current. So that's one of the reasons why they move downstream so quickly is once, and for instance in Noxum Reservoir, when those fish are hatched there, they become entrained right, you know, early in the summer when there's a lot of flow and those fish start moving downstream. So there is definitely a downward flux of the population due to that. Yeah.
So one of the important points, though, is we've fought this battle with lake trout, but lake trout have lower reproductive potential, so they take longer to mature, they have far fewer eggs. Walleye have roughly probably an order of magnitude more eggs that they produce. They mature earlier, so they can mature at reef maturity in just 2 or 3 years, whereas lake trout often are taking 6 to 8 years. So we've seen in other places where walleye become established, once they get there, they can more quickly increase and reach high levels of abundance, whereas lake trout have been slower to take off, even though they still present a problem here. Walleye are an even tougher critter to keep from getting out ahead of it.
You mentioned that Montana is not participating in this program. Is Montana doing anything to control walleye in Noxum, or is it just going to continue to be a perpetual source of walleye in the garden system?
At this point, they're not. They don't have harvest limits on them, from what I understand, but they're not doing any active suppression or work at trying to deal with that. And, yeah. Oh, boy. Okay, we'll start over here.
We're going to get into talking about water temperatures in a few more talks, and I'm wondering if you know what temperatures the walleye prefer, or do they survive well in warmer rivers like Priest River?
I don't know a lot about that. Andy, can you?
Well, I'm not going to give you specific numbers, but we have walleye are what we call cool water fish, so they're somewhere between we call cold water fish, which are things like lake trout and cutthroat and bull trout. And then you have warm water fish that are species like largemouth and smallmouth bass, for example. So walleye are kind of in between, kind of like northern pike, so they can tolerate a little bit warmer water than some of our cold water trout species, but generally not as don't do as well in real warm environments like a largemouth bass.
There's another question back here.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm not sure.
I'll stand up.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
With the reproduction potential you just discussed with these fish, and the fact that they can double their population in 3 years, or they have in the past, wouldn't it make more sense to get more money involved in that setting program if you're wanting to slow down this population explosion? Is there any way you can get more money in that program?
I think at this point we're starting off, you know, relatively conservatively. I think we're stepping into it, you know, with our eyes wide open. But I think at the same time, you know, we need to understand how the fishery is going to develop and how the program is going to develop. And that's why we propose this, and we're doing it as a pilot study. Understand after this first year how it develops, what it looks like, what sort of participation we have. And then I think we can modify it as we move forward to where it makes most sense. Right, sir.
You made a comment that walleye are impacting our fishery. Can you tell us what species you consider to be the worst species and what criteria you use to make a fish species either part of what you manage or what you don't?
Walleye have a threat to impact the ecosystem as Ponderay as a whole. I think that it's not one species or another that we're talking about. You know, kokanee are a keystone species to Ponderay. A lot of the fisheries there depend on kokanee, and I think that a threat to the kokanee population is definitely something that we're concerned about. However, you know, when walleye have been introduced into systems throughout the West, they've had a large impact on everything, and I think that that's the concern that we're more worried about. And so when we talk about our fishery, I think we're talking about the fishery of the lake as it stands right now.
So we've done a lot of work over the years to understand what do anglers want out of the Ponderay fishery. And it's been very clearly stated that folks value what we'll call the traditional fishery that's been largely focused and supported by kokanee. It involves the trophy fishery for rainbow trout, supports native bull trout and cutthroat trout. So that has been the fishery that folks have told us loud and clear that they value and want to manage for, and that's why we've put so much energy into things like lake trout suppression to recover the kokanee fishery and to get back better trophy angling out there and whatnot. So because of the investment that's been made in that fishery and the continued support from the public to manage for that type of fishery, that's what we're trying to do here with walleye. We're trying to keep walleye from coming in and disrupting that fishery that we're managing for. And, you know, there's a lot to be learned. We don't yet know if this suppression approach between incentivized angling and some of the netting we're doing, we don't know if that's going to be a tool yet that we can use to keep walleye from getting out ahead of us. But we certainly have had a lot of input. We met with a panel of experts last year, folks from in the native range of walleye and other folks who have worked with walleye in places in the West where they've invaded. And that way we could get some information, not just looking at our internal assessment of what the risk was, but bringing in folks that were kind of independent and had a lot of expertise with walleye. And it was very clear from that meeting that everyone agreed unanimously that walleye are a threat to the system. We can expect them to, if the population continues to increase, be an effective predator on kokanee, and the added predation of walleye may put on kokanee in the system are very much a threat to sustaining kokanee. And they also are an effective predator on other trout species such as bull trout and cutthroat and rainbow trout that we're trying to manage for here. So there's a pretty strong history of the negative impacts that walleye have in what we're trying to manage for cold water species. So anyway, that's why we're being really aggressive and proactive.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hey, going back to the comment made by the gentleman earlier on what Montana not participating, what would be your ask that this group should make Montana for the pay attention to this? What would you ask them to
do?
So one of the projects that we're just getting started is we're trying to understand how many walleye are coming into Ponderay from upstream on an annual basis, and how many of those walleye are being produced within the system. And that's going to be a really pivotal question as we decide how to move forward with walleye management. If we are getting most of the walleye production from in the Ponderay system, downstream of Montana, then that means we might have a better opportunity to do things in Idaho to keep them from getting out of hand. Now, if we learn that we're getting a high percentage of those walleye downstream from Montana every year, then that's going to limit what we can do. And if that's the case, then we would be more dependent, I guess, on what happens in Montana to control our situation. So we're going to try to get that question answered this year, doing some research to look at what proportion of the walleye that are in Ponderay originated in Montana versus within Idaho. And so once we have that, I think we'll have a better understanding of just, yeah, what role Montana, you know, has in this whole thing.
Well, with the science that you have now, and having personally had them as table fare in the past from fish being brought in from Canada and otherwise, and the fact that I have a brother-in-law that fishes across from McLean a lot, they are great table fare. You might have possibly just advertising, hey, we need to get these fish sat here. Eat walleye.
Guys
from back east with net boats like they've done in the past. We've got a lot of people around here. Walleye is not a fish that takes a tremendous amount of money to fish for. We don't have a whole lot of rich people here that are looking for massive big fish. Tell them to eat fish.
I think that that's an important part to bring up is that with the lake trout program, we had two different prongs. We did the incentivized angling and we also did the net. And the angling was very important from that perspective right there. The public can be involved and can be a part of the solution. I showed you a graph earlier that had the numbers of walleye, or the numbers of lake trout, I'm sorry, that were collected, anglers versus the net boat. One thing that happened with that I didn't show you is when you look at the number of anglers that participated in that fishery and participated in the Lake Trout Angler Incentive Program, the majority of the anglers that participated submitted relatively few fish per year. So what that means to me is that we have a broad angler base that are all participating in this program. It's not like we have two or three people that are really good at catching lake trout and we're paying them to do that fire on the rim. The other thing that's important is that the Angler Incentive Program with Lake Trout are, anglers are able to target a portion of the population that we are unable to effectively target with the netting program. The netting program is really good at catching small lake trout, and it's also very good at catching smaller lake trout in the fall. But that intermediate size range is the size that the anglers have been targeting specifically. So yeah, eat walleye, please. I mean, that's definitely what we're trying to get at here, and we're trying to go beyond just a campaign that says eat walleye, but we're saying eat walleye and maybe make a whole bunch of money from it. Go ahead.
Can walleye get over the outlet bay dam recently, or are they already?
From what we know, they are not up that far, and I'm not too concerned that they're going to make it up over Outlet Bay Dam. I don't know that for sure, but I think our concern is the lower river more so than making it up into Priest at this point. But I think that's part of the equation is trying to keep this population limited to where they're not trying to stray to some of these more marginal habitats and moving as far as they can. Yeah, Donna? Yeah, from what we're seeing with pike, there's two different issues there that are I think important. The first thing is pike are much more tied to shoreline habitat and nearshore emergent vegetation for their life cycle, and Pondere doesn't have a whole lot of that. We've had pike around for quite a while. I'm not sure exactly how long, but the populations have been relatively stable at a relatively low level with pike. So even though they are as much of a predator potentially, there's just we're not seeing the potential for their population to really expand and increase like we do with walleye. Walleye can move offshore. We know they eat kokanee. We know that they can inhabit a whole lot more of the lake than pike can. Yeah, very well could be. With the data that I showed you, that's the first time that we actually caught a walleye in one of our surveys. So that was data that I had that we could put a thumb on. Go ahead, follow up.
Is there a greater chance of net and walleye catching other species than there is lake trout? Because in fact, lake trout so deep, usually I think that there's a less chance of catching. If you're going shoreline for walleye, is there a greater chance of catching and depleting other species?
So the netting that we did, I don't know, are you going to talk much about that, Andy? Okay, the netting that we did do some pilot netting last spring, and there were other species that were caught, specifically smallmouth, which is I'm sure kind of where you're heading with this potentially, but the one thing that did happen, we do relatively short sets. Those smallmouth don't really get get hung in gill nets fatally, very bad. They get hung in gill nets because they're spiny and they get tangled easily. But they don't really penetrate that net so hard that they get killed in the net itself. We do relatively short sets, and I don't remember exactly the numbers of the smallmouth that we caught. But I do know that I think every one of them were released alive, and they were looking good going out. I mean, we're definitely aware.
Okay, then
yeah,
one smallmouth is way different than what you think. Why are we not worried about smallmouth? I've seen them take over the river below the dam. I have to live right at the dam. I do a lot of fishing from shore right below the dam. The smallmouth, you don't have to catch anymore.
And I think the smallmouth is similar to the pike answer, in that there's relatively, at least specifically within the lake, there's a relatively limited smallmouth habitat along the shoreline, and they haven't had the haven't shown the impact on the overall fishery the same as lake trout and that potentially walleye would do. Do you want to add to that?
So we've done work with smallmouth too, and what we've seen is that they definitely will eat kokanee. We have places like Coeur d'Alene Lake, Dorchak Reservoir, where kokanee are a big part of the diet. So if you like smallmouth, kokanee still are helping that smallmouth fishery. But the good news is smallmouth are actually pretty compatible with kokanee. You know, like Ken said, they're just not showing the same amount of overlap with kokanee. They're again pretty restricted to the shorelines. There's a lot of good shoreline habitat for smallmouth and providing a good fishery there, but they don't have the ability to kind of move further offshore like walleye can. So what we found in other systems, like Coeur d'Alene Lake is a great example. We have an outstanding smallmouth bass fishery there. We're also able to sustain a really high density kokanee population. So there's a lot of other examples like that show us that we can manage four smallmouth and allow smallmouth to be present in these systems with few negative impacts, and there's actually a lot of benefits that anglers can enjoy from them. So we don't have to be aggressively managing against smallmouth in a system like this. But the walleye are a different beast.
I was just wondering, is there any plan of having the experts come back that you had last year at any point in time to see how our plan is working on the walleye?
Yeah, so her question was, are we going to have this expert panel reconvene again? And I think there's a chance we may. And one thing we have done is we've stayed in contact with those folks. So even though we haven't had another meeting this year, we've gotten very clear direction from those folks in terms of, here's what our plan is, what do you guys think of that? And they wholeheartedly supported the approach we're taking. So we're going to stay engaged with them, and there may be an opportunity where we reconvene. But I think right now the focus is on trying to, for a few years here, get out and try to do some of these things that, see what are our tools in the toolbox. Can we use angling as a tool to help keep walleye from getting ahead of us? Can we use targeted netting to help keep walleye from getting out ahead of us? Would we have to use one or both of those in conjunction to try to keep this thing from getting ahead of us? At the same time, doing some additional research, like, we don't have time to go into it today. We have a lot of new research going on. We've got telemetry going on, so we've got walleye that have transmitters in them, receivers around the lake, so we're sort of understand how these things work through the lake, where do they spend their time. The project I mentioned earlier to look at how many walleye are we getting from Montana versus in the system. So we're really putting an emphasis here in the next few years over really trying to understand more about the population, how they operate here, and what our abilities might be to manage them.
One more part. Aaron's been trying to ask a question for
Bob. Sorry, I have a lot of hands up there.
Aaron,
yeah.
I'll take it somewhere in the mix there. So it was about the
Oh, okay.
Any other questions on this topic? Andy, why don't you just go ahead and move into Priest and Monterey? We're still good schedule-wise, so go right ahead on Priest.
Okay. Well, we'll switch gears here. And the intent of this presentation is just to kind of get everybody up to speed on something that isn't brand new. In fact, this is something that we've largely had buttoned up for a while now and might really be new news to some of you who've been tracking this. But I wanted to just let you know where things now stand with the future management direction for Priest and Upper Priest Lakes. I think it's probably been a couple of years. I know I've been to this group before and kind of explained the management planning process we were going through at the time, and that's now completed. But just to give you a little bit of background, you know, we have what we call a fisheries management plan for the state of Idaho, and that on a drainage-by-drainage basis sort of sets our management direction, so the policy that kind of guides how we manage fish populations throughout the state. And so when we put the last fish management plan together that ran from 2013 to 2018, we were at the time getting a lot of questions from folks about how did we want to manage Priest Lake. At the time, we were starting to see some of the really positive impacts from the lake trout suppression work we'd done in Ponderay, and we were seeing kokanee come back, and we were getting questions from anglers that are interested in Priest saying, well, could you do the same thing on Priest Lake and bring kokanee back in Priest and do good things for cutthroat and bull trout in Priest? And so at the time, we went out to the public, some scoping, and what we learned was that folks were pretty divided on that issue. There were about half of the people that said, well, we really like Priest as it is. We like having that lake trout fishery there, and we don't care so much about the ability to fish for kokanee or having native species at a higher abundance. So we also had at the time recognition that there was a fair bit we didn't know about the Priest Lake system, and we needed some more contemporary information on the status of some of the different fish populations there. And so we, at the time, built into the fish management plan that expired in 2018 a number of things. We kind of doubled down on the monitoring research we were doing there to learn more about some of the different fish populations, but we also formed the Priest Lake Fishery Advisory Committee. So that was a group of, I forget exactly now, a dozen or so folks that we picked from around the community, some of whom are here today, I know. And we worked with that group for several years. We started meeting in 2013. I guess I'm now figuring out I can do this. And the goal was to have that group help us come up with some ideas for how we might manage Priest Lake moving forward, again, once we got into the new management planning period. And so we met a lot of times with that group. We got a lot of input from folks. They represented a lot of different interests. We had folks that were interested in kokanee fishing, folks that were interested in lake trout fishing. We had folks that represented business interests in the Priest Lake area. So kind of this nice representation of folks that brought different perspectives to the table. And ultimately, after a lot of meetings and learning more as this new research came in, this group helped us set several management alternatives that we could take out to the public again for feedback. So when we started out, I think every person on the stakeholder group had their own alternative that they brought to the table. Over a bunch of meetings, we kind of beat those up, and people found ways to kind of make some compromises and come together, and the idea was to boil that down to as few alternatives as possible before it went out for general public feedback. So the group was able to get that down to three alternatives, and so we then rolled those three alternatives out for general public input in 2017. And to start with, I just want to run through what those are. So the first one basically is just status quo. Continue to manage the Priest Lake and Upper Priest Lake systems as we have been, which basically means manage for a sustainable yield lake trout fishery and allow sustainable harvest of lake trout in Priest Lake. And then continue to do, if you're not familiar, we've been actually doing lake trout suppression at Upper Priest Lake for a couple decades now. And so that's been just at a low level. We go in there in May for about 2 weeks, and we've been able to keep lake trout density low enough that native cutthroat and bull trout have continued to do well there. So this alternative included basically manage Priest Lake as you have been, continue managing the upper lake for native species. The second alternative was to try to restore a kokanee population that could support a harvest fishery in Priest Lake and also enhance native cutthroat and bull trout in Priest and Upper Priest. So basically, this is the alternative that says we're going to go in and we're going to try to reduce lake trout abundance because lake trout are the limitation. If you have lake trout in Priest Lake, it's going to prevent you from having an abundant kokanee population. So this would effectively mean going in and suppressing lake trout, either through angling or netting or both, much like we've done in Ponderay. So, major change, but trying to bring back what would have been kind of the traditional historical fishery in Priest Lake. And then the third alternative that the group came up with was sort of a hybrid. I call this the mixed species fishery. It was basically something that would try to have a little of everything, where you'd go in and see if you could have maybe partial suppression of the lake trout population, reduce their density enough that you could have more kokanee in the lake, do some good things for native species, but you wouldn't do the full-blown suppression approach. So once we had those three alternatives ready to go out to the public, we ended up having three public meetings, one in Priest River, one in Coeur d'Alene, and one in Coulin. We did a lot of public outreach through a number of news releases and other information we got out in the media, not only to let people know about those meetings, but just to let them know about this issue. And then we followed that with a number of different opinion surveys. And so first one was a random mail survey that went out to license holders from our license database. So anyone who we had sold a fishing license to was randomly selected and got an envelope in the mail with a survey in it. And this is kind of the best method, most accepted method to get the most unbiased responses as possible. But we also wanted to just cast a wide net and use some other survey tools that, although they may not be quite as unbiased, they still, we thought, would provide a lot of opportunity for people to give us input. So we did a web-based survey where you could just go to our website, take this same survey that we mailed out to people, or you potentially would have gotten an email survey. So when you buy your fishing license, you have the option of giving us your email address. And so everyone in our license database that we had an email address for, we sent this survey to them as well. So I'm just going to roll through what we learned from doing all this survey work. For starters, we did the mail survey. We sent that out to 5,000 people. Got about 1,000 and just over 1,000 of those back. The email survey went out to about 10,000 people. We got 400 of those back. And then online, where you just go to our website, take the survey, we had close to 800 people take that survey. And then we also had folks that filled out surveys like at the public meetings and such. So in total, we ended up hearing from over 2,000 people, which is a really good sample for this type of thing. This was a great survey effort. And particularly this mail survey was a really nice survey that gave us some good information. We sent these mail and email surveys out. Like I said, for the random mail survey, we had a stratified design. It went out to folks by county, so we didn't just send these to, you know, folks that all lived in Kootenai County. I mean, we made sure we went and sent surveys to folks in each of the five northern counties, but that was weighted a bit so that folks in Bonner County had more sent out since Priest Lake was more localized to them. And then, like I said, the email survey went out to anybody we had an email address for. So what we learned in the end here is that the mail and email surveys, we asked folks, you know, do you fish on Priest Lake? Have you ever? Did you used to, but maybe you don't anymore? Or are you an avid Priest Lake angler? Or maybe more of a casual Priest Lake angler? So a bunch of different questions that allowed us to get an idea. Who's filling this out? Are these people that fish Priest Lake a lot, or people that hardly ever fish there? And as we go through the results, you'll see why that was a little bit more helpful to us than not asking those things. So this kind of distills down from the surveys whether people wanted no change, they wanted us to leave things alone, or whether they wanted alternative two or three. So basically some form of change, either the full-blown, you know, bring back our old fishery or the mixed fishery approach that I mentioned. And so what we learned from this, the mail survey, again, this is kind of the gold standard survey that should be the least biased. We had about a quarter of the people that just didn't have an opinion. But of the people that did have an opinion, about a third of them said, you know, they were supporting change. Another third of the folks didn't want change. So here we are again, just like we were several years ago where we had really two camps, you know. About half the people wanted change and half of them didn't. We saw a somewhat similar response in the email surveys. I mean, again, pretty similar split here. And then once you get into like the online survey, you start seeing a lot of these people didn't want change. But keep in mind, the web-based surveys tend to motivate people who are really energized in the issue and have something they stand to lose. And so we tend to have those be more biased. And so we got a lot of people filling that out that were, you know, local anglers that like lake trout fishing and such. So we broke this down a little bit and looked at past anglers. folks that used to fish Priest Lake maybe don't anymore. And this is from all people. I forgot to mention, we sent this to the five northern counties, but we also sent a smaller sample out to folks in Pondre and Spokane counties in Washington to get some non-resident feedback. So this left side shows everybody, Idaho and Washington folks. This side shows just Idaho folks. And again, these are folks that used to fish Priest Lake. And so, you know, what we learned here is that there's a higher percentage of folks who favored changing the fishery, bringing back that historical fishery. Fewer folks that supported just leaving it alone. Whereas as we move through here, these are what we call regular anglers. These are folks that fish Priest Lake pretty consistently, but aren't what we'd call avid, not the real hardcore Priest Lake angler. And again, we had, what you see here is there was more of an even split. In fact, we had more folks here that wanted us to kind of just leave things alone, less support for change. And then as you move into the more avid anglers, people that fish Priest Lake a lot, we had an even higher percentage of folks that didn't want change. They wanted us to leave things alone. Less support for change. So you see, a lot of this depends on what type of angler you are. You know, if you're out there fishing Priest Lake a lot right now, that means you probably like the kind of fishery that's there. You wouldn't be out fishing. So we kind of have to tease this stuff apart. The other thing we did is looked at it by county. And these were the results, like I said, the Idaho counties, and then also Pondre and Spokane counties. And really just the take-home here I want to share with you is, you know, do you support the no-change alternative? And you can see it was relatively consistent across the different counties. There was a little variation. But in general, we had about, again, a third of the people that said, yeah, we don't want change. But then we also had about a third of the people across all these different counties that said, no, I want a different type of fishery. I'd like you to bring back kokanee or whatever it may be. We had a bunch of people that just didn't offer opinion and some didn't offer response. So really what it boils down to is these are the people that gave us some kind of input. And again, look at these numbers. We're pretty evenly split. So what it meant was that in the end, we were kind of where we were when we started, but I think we were in a much better place because we had a lot more information. We did a much better job of going out to the public, casting a wide net, having the stakeholder group involved, and laid all these options out for everybody, and lots of people weighed in. And the fact that we hadn't even split told us that there wasn't overwhelming support to change what we're doing on Priest Lake. So as a result of that, we recommended alternative one, the no change alternative, keep things the way they are, because in order to make some kind of a major change in how we're managing Priest Lake, it would involve things like going out and getting a whole bunch of funding, which we weren't certain where that might come from or if we could do it. It would involve doing things like starting a large-scale lake trout suppression program, which we knew probably, you know, half of the people would not support. So to make that kind of change, we'd need to see overwhelming public support to get something like that off the ground. We just frankly didn't see that. So our option at this point was to recommend alternative one, no change. The next step was then to take that recommendation and put it in our fish management plan that we were working on developing in 2018. That fish management plan then went back out for public input. So there was sort of a second round of public input. Folks had their opportunity to weigh in. And ultimately, that plan was approved by the Idaho Fish and Game Commission this past November. And so now we are operating, as of January 1, under this new fish management plan. So for the next 6 years, we have management direction set for Priest and Upper Priest Lake. And that effectively says that we're going to continue managing the main lake as we have been. We'll continue to manage the upper lake for native species by doing some lake trout suppression. So just to kind of remind you what this is going to look like, here's what our management targets will be under this new management plan. For kokanee, we're just going to have the status quo. We're not going to be managing for a kokanee fishery up there because we can't with lake trout in the system. So what folks can expect is a low density of kokanee in Priest Lake. They're probably going to bounce around a little bit naturally, but they're going to be at a low level and not offer a particularly good fishery. Lake trout will be status quo. Basically, that's going to mean we should still expect a high-density population that can sustain high enough catch rates and harvest that you can go out there and have pretty good catch rates for lake trout and keep some lake trout.
But these aren't going to be big trophy lake trout that you may have been familiar with, you know, several decades ago, because there aren't enough kokanee out there to support, you know, at least very many of these bigger lake trout. Your standard lake trout's going to be an 18 to 24 inch fish in that system with an occasional big one maybe out there, but not a trophy lake trout fishery. Cutthroat again, kind of what we have now. There's low to moderate density of cutthroat. At this point, we don't feel there's a high enough density to support a harvest fishery, but there are enough cutthroat out there to offer some good fishing for folks that pursue that. And those fish are certainly we're gonna focus on trying to conserve or enhance those in Upper Priest Lake by keeping lake trout at the low density. Bull trout, again, what we can expect is main Priest Lake effectively has very few bull trout in it. They basically have collapsed in Priest Lake itself. Bull trout and lake trout don't get along well in the same system, so we've seen that population suffer. But in the upper lake, we're going to try to maintain bull trout up there by doing that lake trout suppression. We now have smallmouth bass. They're pretty abundant in Priest Lake. So what we're planning to do there is just continue to have what we do now, pretty liberal harvest for smallmouth bass. But as I mentioned earlier, you know, that probably will be some added opportunity, but smallmouth aren't necessarily a major threat to this system. They're certainly going to consume some other fish, but from what we've seen so far anyway, we don't have the same concerns about smallmouth increased as we would, say, walleye and pongray. So, the future of management, what are we going to potentially do under this new management plan in Priest Lake? Well, effectively, we're going to be doing mostly what we're doing now, which is every time we have a new fishing rule cycle, we look and see, okay, are the current fishing rules working well or are there changes needed? And our new rules just came out from 2019 to 2021, and we actually did make a few changes that are specific to Upper Priest Lake. The first one is we had public support for moving to unlimited harvest of lake trout in Upper Priest Lake. Not the main lake, but still going to have the standard six fish limit, but in Upper Priest Lake, you can now go up there and catch any lake trout as you'd like. And that's because that's more consistent with how we're managing Upper Priest Lake. If we're going to go in there and do a couple weeks of lake trout suppression with nets every spring, we might as well let anglers have that same opportunity to go up and harvest as many and be part of that solution. So that change is now in effect. And there had been a no bait and barbless hook rule in Upper Priest Lake, and that was not kind of an artifact of some rule simplification that got done historically. But there wasn't really any biological basis to not allow in Priest Lake folks to use bait or barbed hooks. And if you're going to go up there and fish for lake trout, having to use no bait and, you know, barbless hooks wasn't real consistent with trying to encourage lake trout harvest up there. So we made that change for the upper lake. Main lake rules are the same as they had been. So like I mentioned, we'll continue to do the lake trout suppression Upper Priest Lake. However, that's funding dependent. We're out chasing grant money every year to get that funded. We're not using, we don't really have sportsman dollars dedicated to that. This has been through a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service grant program and some funding support from the Kalispell Tribe to do that. So we'll do that as much as we can, but it is a funding challenge to keep it going. And then we'll look at other things like habitat improvement and tributaries as we can. There's been work going on in use port to try to improve some habitat there, and so there may be other opportunities like that. But these are the types of things you can expect moving forward. So, I guess with that, if we have time for questions.
Questions on Priest Lake fisheries.
I saw your hand first.
The interesting thing to me about this is somebody's been here most of my life in the area and whatnot is and fishing. You're talking about fish that eat fish. And one thing I'm not hearing anything about is forage fish. You got all these fish doing this, nothing big, nothing here or there, and then the historic fish there that we had were not what people were wanting. Mackinac were an invasive. They were brought from elsewhere. Kokanee were brought from elsewhere. And then they brought in mice and shrimp. You got all this stuff coming from elsewhere, and you've got nothing left forage fish to feed all these fish. So what are you going to do with that situation? Because there are a lot of eaters out there and nothing much to eat. They're eating each other.
Okay. So in the Priest Lake system, the forage fish, so to speak, has been kokanee. Kokanee have been the food source that have allowed fish like lake trout, bull trout to do well in this system in, you know, the last, since we've had those species present. So
we cannot sustain many kokanee in the presence of lake trout. Part of why we went into this whole project, to see what we could do about that. So unless we're going to reduce a lake trout population, we don't really have the ability to support a high density forage fish like a kokanee in the system. And so I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
Well, in essence, you have. What we have, a beautiful lake and whatnot, a lot of people there and whatnot, that you have an invasive species problem, not on a lake, what we're collecting from Montana coming downstream. Somebody wanted to create something like that. Then I'm not old enough to remember what the fishery was like, Priest Lake was like, okay, before all that stuff came in.
So before all that stuff came in, we had a fishery that basically involved native species. We had bull trout was kind of the predator fish, and then we had cutthroat trout and mountain whitefish were the primary food sources for them. At the time, there was very popular fisheries for cutthroat and bull trout. People very much valued those. A lot of people still do. But to try to sustain that type of a fishery in the presence of these non-natives that are now established is the real challenge. And it gets into this value-based thing. Do people value having a non-native lake trout population to go fish for, and if that comes at the expense of having, you know, smaller lake trout, have a big size, and have fewer native species in the system, poorer fishing for cutthroat, and effectively, like I said, people are pretty split on that issue, and we're trying to find out how to satisfy, you know, competing values. So
that seems like to be a really tough thing.
Yeah, it has been a really tough thing. You can ask any of the stakeholders that sat in on that process. It was a challenging process. Yeah. Yeah, I'm really not. I mean, we already have, you can go to a lot of other lake fisheries, go to Pendre, for example, and we have a very outstanding bull trout fishery there. We have strong cutthroat numbers, and folks are allowed to fish under those rules. Yeah.
Yeah, Priest Lake, the main Priest Lake, is a bull trout critical habitat. I'm curious how fish is going to get away with managing four lake trout
Okay, so his question is, why are we not obligated by law to try to bring back bull trout and Maine Priest since they're listed under the ESA? And the response to that is, we certainly, one of our charges is to preserve, protect, perpetuate, so native species are a big part of that. Keeping native species doing well. The challenge there is that we also have to have public acceptance in order to get programs on the ground that will do those things. And in this particular instance, we don't have enough public support to go do that. And so you can't just go in and say this is the right thing to do if the public that we serve is not supporting that. So that was the whole point of this process, to see what are people willing to support with that. And part of the what I view as a victory in this whole process for native species is that the public did tell us, the stakeholders told us this, the public supported this, that in Upper Priest folks did value that we were addressing the lake trout issue and trying to maintain strong cutthroat and bull trout numbers in the upper lake. But folks weren't willing to go so far as to say, hey, we want you to tear down the fishery in the main lake and try to do the same thing there.
Well, as far as I see it, the fishery
is violating
the
species. No, we haven't. Yeah, Jason's here. You want to address it?
So, under the ESA, this part is focused on, the ESA is focused on federal actions. This is the state action. So there's not, I mean, just from a purely regulatory legal standpoint, there's not an avenue. So what, like you said, this is more of a reflection of the values and what's the priority in the local area. The outcome, you know, if the local population of fishing is like, well, this just isn't possible and it's not something that's deemed important enough for the, you know, idea of needing to manage the lower lake specifically for bull trout, what you end up with is you have that decreases your chance of delisting the population and recovering it, so you have a listed population there for however long it takes to get back to recovery, or
Take. Not a direct action by the state. That's now they do have a take permit for the gill netting activities on the main on the pond area in the upper reef. But not for this because it's not, again, it's not a federal action, there's no federal nexus there. And also because it's not a direct action, it's more just maintenance.
Other questions?
Go ahead.
Well, my question is, if we're trying to, I get the survey thing, and that's great for you guys to try it, and of course that's what I think about it, but I'm a little confused on the lakefront part in the main lake, in that how much of an impact would that, I'm not talking gill netting them, but if we just, what is the limit on lake trout in the main lake?
Six fish days limit.
Right. Why is there even a limit on it? Are they going to catch that many lake trout to where it's going to, eliminate the lake trout, at the same time it's
going to
be helping
the cooking. So we have a limit on lake trout there because the management emphasis has been to manage for lake trout, not to try to drive them down. So if folks were telling us that they wanted us to manage against lake trout and try to bring back these other species, we probably would take that limit off and go to unlimited. But in this case, folks are telling us, no, we want a sustainable harvest fishery for lake trout, in which case we have a daily bag limit to try to reduce the risk that there's going to be too much harvest and threaten that.
Okay, I misunderstood what some people were saying, and I thought that they would disagree with gill netting on the main lake, and as I disagreed with that, I said, let the fish hook.
Well, there were some people that just didn't want us putting nets out there and said, so in that case, we support the no change alternative. But there were a lot of folks, actually, the majority of those folks were saying, no, we actually value having lake trout. We like fishing for lake trout. We want to continue to be able to fish for lake trout. So we want no part of you changing this fishery. That's what we're hearing from most of that camp. Yeah, right here.
In your opinion, how did the smallmouth get increased lake?
Well, so we don't know that for certain. They either would have been illegally transported there or they would have moved up through Outlet Dam. And so it's possible that that could have happened. We don't know which one of those scenarios
it was. You don't think walleye are going to get there the same way?
They very well could. We don't know for sure, but that possibility is there. We have had lake trout that we've put transmitters in at Lake Ponderay make their way to Priest Lake. So it isn't a complete passage barrier. No. Yeah. It is a possibility. I saw one back here. Yeah.
So I've been to a few of these meetings, and I've heard Fish and Game talk about specifically controlling the lake trout from getting up into Priest Lake and try to upper Priest Lake so that we could hopefully keep a viable bull trout and keep a cutthroat trout population up there. But it's two of the last meetings I heard more in depth about that really depends on if grants keep coming in for netting, and they could dry up at any time. And if they do, then lake trout will not be suppressed in the thoroughfare any longer, and they most likely will make their way into the upper lake. And then there's a good possibility that cutthroat and the grass and bull trout up there will go. It's all contingent on the whims and the funding that's possible or not possible to continue the netting. So yeah. I've heard more than once that it takes public outcry to make things happen, and the people are complacent, and we're willing to just sit back and hope Fish and Game can successfully get grants each year. And nobody's getting adamant that we need to put permanent funding in place. Not be at the mercy of whether or not a grant comes or does not come. So if you care about bull trout, you care about native species, and you don't want to see them wiped out in the thoroughfare, please become active. Start talking to your legislators, federal and state, and make it clear that there aren't any places left in the world like the upper lake. And if you want to protect it, you personally have to take some responsibility and make sure that our legislators fund this and that let your people know. If
if you don't care, okay, sit back and then you go catch as many trees like large fish up at the upper lake as well.
Okay.
In a few years.
No, so I understand your concern, and you are right that maintaining strong populations of cutthroat bull trout in Upper Priest Lake at this point in time is dependent on our ability to suppress lake trout. And our ability to do that is dependent on having funding to go do the work. And I can assure you that we have heard from the public that they value us continuing to do that work. We are interested in doing everything we can to maintain some kind of funding stream to do that work. Like I said, we've had good funding support from the Fish and Wildlife Service grant and the Kalispell Tribe that have allowed us to do that. But you also need to recognize our agency, we are getting general funds. We are a sportsman dollar-driven agency, so we're dependent on licensed dollars from sportsmen. We don't have the ability to go to our legislator and get general fund money. So. And the other thing I'll add to that is we are looking at trying to think creatively about what other possible, now that we've gotten this direction from folks, they really are on board with us continuing what we're doing in Upper Priest. We're trying to think creatively. What are some other possible funding sources that we can pursue? Because frankly, there has been uncertainty about whether we're going to get Fish and Wildlife Service money. The service is kind of reprioritized from what we're understanding, Upper Priest Lake, and de-emphasized the importance of doing that work, which is frustrating to us. But we're looking to see if there are other alternatives. We're also doing some work in Upper Priest this year, putting some transmitters out in lake trout to try to learn more about where they spawn in the lake to see if we can target them at different times of year that would maybe take less effort and be less costly so that we can reduce how much it costs us every year to do that. So anyway, we're trying to think outside the box right now, and we're going to do everything we can to keep that going.
Are you working with the Northwest Garden Planning Council at all in coordinating their requirements for maintaining native fisheries and treaties with Canada, et cetera? And is there funding there or some kind of help?
Well, we do work with that group on some of the projects that we have. So, for example, we have we get Bonneville Power funding for two of our research programs in the region, one on the Kootenai and one on Lake Pend'Oreille, but that funding is not available for Upper Priest Lake. So anyway, the short answer to your question, we are engaged with that group, and I'm not aware of something there at the moment that is an opportunity for us.
Other questions before we move on to the cold water fishery?
All right, well, thank you.
So we'll move on to Chip Corsi, who's going to present on the cold water augmentation table. I did want to make an announcement before this program starts. We did receive several letters in opposition to the cold water bypass concept. Those letters will all be made a part of our record here today. We received letters from Donna Herrick and Fred Enlow and Peter Bach, and those letters will be, our record is pretty much our website. They will be, I don't know if they're on there yet, but they will be put on when we regularly update the website. So I just want to make a note that we did receive a few letters from Ms. Herrick and letters from Mr. Enlow and Mr. Bach. And with that, Chip, we'll turn things over to you, and be sure to give us a little bit of background on this whole thing as to how we got where you are today. So thanks.
All right. Thank you, Ford. Morning, everybody. I will have a fair bit of background. Some of it will be familiar to those of you who have seen me present on this topic in previous years, but we do have some new information to share as well. So the goals, what I want to hopefully convey today is why we're considering this. what the concept is, and it's still very much a concept. It's not a project. It's not a proposal. It's a concept. Help you understand what process we're using, and then field questions. So why would we consider this in the first place? Andy referred to our fish and game mission briefly in his talk. That was handed to us in 1938 by Citizen Initiative. It directs us to preserve, protect, perpetuate, and manage Idaho's fish and wildlife, and to manage that to provide fishing and hunting opportunities. So in essence, it's a conservation mission, and it's a mission to do things like make fishing better, which is really what this is about. Under the Clean Water Act, states are required to assess waters in their states and identify whether they are water quality limited or not. Priest River, below the lake, is identified as a water quality limited segment, and the water quality limiting factor is temperature. I'm presenting at the Lakes Commission, and this is the charge that the legislature gave the Lakes Commission when it was formed, I don't know, 15, 16, 17 years ago. But it basically directs the Lakes Commission to kind of keep tabs on water quality, water quantity, as it relates to the waters in the Priest and Pend'Oreille basins, and also protect the interests of the state, and as it pertains to native fish. And this is also about native fish. So what's the problem in Priest River? We compare two different northern Idaho rivers that are similar in size, similar in length, similar in watershed size. We have two different stories. The North Fork of the Coeur d'Alene has an excellent trout fishery. Roughly 800 fish per mile. That's a density of just about 2 fish per 100 meters squared. If you look a little bit north and west at Priest River, we have a fish density that's about 2 orders of magnitude lower than that. The native fishes in Priest River are bull trout, Westlake cutthroat, not whitefish. Those are the native game species. Those are cold water species. Studies have been conducted by the department over the years. This is Dick Irizarry that did his work in the 1970s. That's about 24 years after the dam was placed at the mouth of Priest Lake, the outlet of Priest Lake. And what he observed in the 1970s is pretty consistent with what we have observed in more recent studies in the 90s and the 2000s, that whitefish are the only game fish that are reasonably abundant, and the trout are actually doing pretty poorly. So, in essence, Priest River is an underperforming cold water fishery. So again, just to kind of recap, why are we doing this? Why are we proposing to look at whether this is feasible to do? It's about protecting native fish, it's about improving water quality, and it's about making fishing better. So where we're at in the process right now is we got funding to look at how we might be able to accomplish providing better habitat for trout and addressing the temperature issue. We contracted with McMillan Jacobs Associates. They're a reputable engineering firm. We're working with a group out of Boise. We gave them some criteria that they needed to look at, and we are very early in that process. We have a rough first draft of an alternatives assessment, which is not a final plan. It's a preliminary assessment of whether we have options that might be feasible to follow up on. So I want to make that really clear. We are very early in the process. There's been some misunderstanding about that. We do not have any set plans. We don't even have a project proposal. We have a concept that we are examining. We're looking at a few different alternatives. Three of those would include withdrawing water from the cold portion of the lake at depth, or the hypolimnion, so what we call hypolimnetic withdrawal. This is a cartoon drawing. This is not an engineer drawing. This is not a proposed plan. It's a concept that to help folks understand how this works. The idea is you draw water from the cold portion of the lake and find a way to deliver it to the river downstream. There are questions about whether you can do that without adding power to the system, in other words, having a pump, whether you can do it on gravity or siphon. We asked them to look into that. And so they have given us three alternatives to dive into a little bit further to look at. Basically, the idea is you would replace a portion of the warm water outflow that comes off the surface of the lake with cold water from the deep portion of the lake to cool the river off downstream and make it suitable, or much more suitable for the cold water species downstream. So what are the things that we have to consider as part of this? Well, we're trying to get water from point A to point B. What direction do we go? If we're going to do this, what direction would we go? Would we push water into a pipe, route it around the overland, bring it down below the dam? Would you push water in a pipe, follow the course of the outflow, see if you can get it there that way? And what are some of the constraints to doing that? Land ownership, etc. So what are some concerns? We have heard loud and clear concerns about the aesthetics if you use a pipe system to go down the outlet corridor, that's not going to be sightly. It might affect navigation. We get that. I guarantee you we get that. And in fact, when we saw a draft report, first draft from the engineers, that included a 4.5-foot diameter pipe going down the outlet, we sent them an email back. This was March 15th after we reviewed it, and we said the two alternatives that include a pipe going down the outlet corridor would not address aesthetic concerns. It's not feasible. I've made that point to a number of people. I recently responded and provided a report to an individual, a copy of the draft report. I made it, I thought, abundantly clear that we have instructed the engineering firm that that's not going to be an acceptable approach. I don't know if that's been understood or not. I hope that is now understood, that that is not going to be acceptable. We get it. Would a proposal like this affect lake level? No. We're talking simply about if we use hypolimnetic withdrawal, replacing a portion of the volume that comes off the surface and goes down to the river, changing that over to water from the deep portion of the lake. Just changing surface water into hypolimnetic water. We have a Priest Lake water plan. We have minimum lake levels that are required by law, those would have to be met. Would added cold water benefit the trout fishery downstream? Well, we know that currently the river exceeds water temperatures for enough of the year, usually late summer, usually typically in August, typically for a period of 2 to 4 weeks, sometimes longer, sometimes shorter, where cold water fish have to find refuge because the water in the main channel is too hot. That means they need to congregate at the mouths of tributaries and things like that. What that translates to is a shrinking in available habitat. That is a limiting factor to that fishery. So the answer is yes, cold water will benefit the cold water species downstream. This is modeling conducted by Portland State University. Many of you have seen this graph before. We've been using it since we started thinking about this idea. The red line is a temperature graph, and that is what is currently seen during the late summer period when air temperatures are high and water temperatures increase. That 19-degree dotted line, 19 degrees Celsius, is the upper limit in water quality, we observe with trout populations, that's when it gets too hot for trout. So clearly, during that time period, we have conditions in the river that are unsuitable for trout. Portland State modeled outflows. If you replace surface flow by 25%, 50%, 75%, cold water from the bottom of the lake, hypomimetic withdrawal. The black line is the 75% line, the green line is the 50% line, and the blue line is the 25% line. Each of those would provide benefits. Clearly the 50% line, and especially the 75% line, would buy you up to 40 miles of improved cold water habitat in what is otherwise structurally, flow-wise, a good quality trout stream, limited by temperature. So you could improve temperature conditions with hypomimetic withdrawal. How would that affect the limnology or ecology of the lake? And that's been a concern that's come up, and that's a legitimate concern. We have, the Portland State people looked at the total volume of the hypolimnion in the lake during that late summer period, estimated what portion of that volume would be needed to meet that 75% outflow of cold water. There's two ways of looking at it. The bar graph, the big blue bar is the total volume. The blue, green, and black are the percentages of that total volume that would come out of the hypolimnion. The bathtub graph, I think there's another, it's another way to look at it. The white is the total volume of the lake. The blue is the total volume of the hypolimnion. The yellow is the total volume that would be used with a 75% withdrawal of cold water from the hypolimnion. It's pretty insignificant. We do not have a limnology study on this yet. If we progress with this further, we will assess this further. But I think the early indications are, in discussion with limnologists, are that it's pretty unlikely that we're going to have an effect on it. Now, there's some other reasons we might think of. And I'll get to that in a few minutes. The fourth alternative that we have from the engineers, and we threw this out as something they might want to look at, is would it be possible to cool the river down without drawing water from the lake and using groundwater pumping? So we asked them to do that. It requires essentially new water, so you would have to have an understanding of whether that volume of water was available. What's the water temperature of groundwater? It's probably pretty cool. It's going to require power constantly to deliver that water because you're pumping it from some depth below. This is not up here to be viewed as an economist version of the cost-benefit ratio, but it is there to give folks an idea of, is this way out there in terms of cost-benefit? Is it in the ballpark of cost-benefit? The data are good. It's from our 2011, they're a little bit dated now, 2011 Sport Fishing Economic Survey. And from that, we knew that the North Fork of the Coeur d'Alene, which we talked about earlier, during the year that this study was conducted, which actually was affected by high water, so it was actually light fishing year. We had over 15,000 trips. People were spending roughly $155 per trip to go fishing. And so that fishery was valued at about $2.4 million that year. The St. Joe, which had an even shorter season that year because of high water, it only supported 5,000 trips. And for those of you who fish the St. Joe, if any of you do, know that in a good year, it's a pretty busy river. People spend more money to go to St. Joe. Part of that is they have to drive further to do it. Part of it is that they're coming from all over. But they spend about $340 a trip. I don't know that folks will spend $340 to fish Creech River. It's much closer to the urban centers of Coeur d'Alene and Spokane. We don't know. So just for the sake of put something out there. We put something about dollar value lower than the North Fork Coeur d'Alene, about 150 a trip. We took an intermediate number of trips. It is in proximity and has good access in terms of public land and roadways down to the river and paths to the river. If you assume 10,000 trips, which is 1.4 angler trips per mile per day, that is not a high density fishery, it would be roughly $1.5 million fishery during that year. That number could be higher, could be lower, but I think it's in the ballpark based on what we see with other northern Idaho rivers of this size that have decent fisheries. One of the things that the preliminary engineering work has done is given some ballpark ideas of what cost for implementation would be. It appears, and there's a lot of work to be done before we can say this with certainty, that it would be substantially less than $10 million to implement a project like this. So, if you look at costs for implementation and you look at potential economic benefits, that's gas, that's room, that's lodging, that's food, that's tackle, that's whatever folks buy when they go fishing, from that standpoint, there's potentially a pretty darn good economic return on this. Talked about public access. Much of the lower river is bordered by either state or federal lands. It's floatable a good portion of the year, which means people can use it to access the river by raft or drift boat or canoe or kayak. So we think it has the ability to support a good fishery in terms of utilization by people if we can get fish to draw them there. A couple of case studies, and this gets back to what I was going to talk about. The nearby one is Sullivan Lake. It's a little bit different, but not that different. They're watering a shorter, smaller creek. They're using hypolimnetic withdrawal. Kalispell Tribe is working on that project with the PUD, and they are finding very good results to date from the cold water fishery, a good response from the cold water fishery downstream that was not there before, without unacceptable impacts to the creek or the lake. Perhaps more similar, in some sense, from a lake standpoint, if we look at Payette Lake down by McCall, it's smaller in surface area than Priest Lake, but it's got a lot of similarities. Similar mean depth, similar total or maximum depth. Volumes and surface area are obviously smaller. It's kind of a small-scale version of Priest Lake in a lot of sense. It's very lagotrophic. The watershed is largely granitic. Since 1979, we've had a fish hatchery downstream from the outlet of Payette Lake on the North Fork of the Payette. And that is watered with lake water. That hatchery is a Chinook fish, a Chinook salmon hatchery. It is a siphon that draws water off the bottom of the lake at about 20 CFS. If you look at the volume of Payette Lake, you look at the volume of water that we draw for the hatchery from that, and then you look at the volume of Priest Lake, the volume of water you would draw if you were to use a cold water hypolimnetic withdrawal. I think you can get an idea that probably not that different. Again, requires further study if we go further with this idea, but water quality in Payette Lake has not suffered from the cold water withdrawal of hypolimnetic water to make that hatchery operate. So where are we in the process? As I said, we're really very early in the process, and I don't know if this process will go further. Personally, I'm optimistic that it will, because I believe there's a ton of opportunity to restore or provide good habitat for cold water fishes, including the native fishes that we've been talking about. And there's an opportunity to create a lot of fishing opportunity for people that would have a lot of benefits, both from an economic and recreational standpoint in the area. But these are the things that we need to understand, and we are really on the front part of this. As I said earlier, the draft report that's got circulated is very much a draft. It is not even a first final draft. It's not a final draft. It's a draft that we've commented on, and clearly we have pointed out that the major flaw in the work that was done in the first draft is not properly addressing the concerns about aesthetics. So I'll make that clear again. Still a concept. We don't have funding for design work. We don't have funding for construction. We hope to get this alternative analysis wrapped up sometime this spring, and then we can start thinking about, is this something we want to do? So that's where we're at. So with that, I'm happy to field any questions from folks.
Okay, well, could we start with commissioners? I do want to make just a disclosure, since I serve on the commission, that I do live on the free-flowing stretch of the Priest River north of town here. Questions first from commissioners.
Right, that's a good question. So the question was, how quickly would a fishery respond once we got through that cold water bottleneck? Fish populations bounce up and down naturally. I think, at first blush, we would look at managing, this is a wild trout fishery. Trout populations, when they are below the carrying capacity of a good piece of habitat, tend to respond more quickly to fill that. But it will take a couple of generations to start seeing that. I can give you maybe an idea on a slightly different place in the Kootenai River where we added nutrients to the river because that was the limiting factor. That has been getting progressively actually quite good, but it's taken about 10 plus years to do that. Whether we would consider trying to jumpstart that with some stocking of Wesso cutthroat or something like that, that's something we would consider. But ideally, we would not manage this as a hatchery-supported fishery, but rather as a wild fishery. So it would take a little bit of time.
Just to clarify, when you say generations, you're talking generations.
Fish generations, which in the case of cutthroat are 4 to 5 years.
Could you just add a little more color on this hatchery that they had 408
to 26 with the problem? So there's a couple of ways to look at that. The minimum flow in. Okay, sorry, thanks, Doug. The question was maybe make the connection or correlation between the Payette situation where we draw 20 CFS for the hatchery and Priest where we would be looking at more water. Is that right, Mark?
Yeah, right.
So at Priest Lake, there's a minimum flow, similar to the lake has a minimum pool of 60 CFS. That's pretty marginal, but that's what the minimum flow is. Typical late summer flows are typically higher than that in a decent water year. In 2015, it got lower than that. But if we took, say, 100 or 120 as a late summer flow that you were trying to augment, you would probably, at 75% of that, would be somewhere in the neighborhood of 75 to 90 CFS. I think proportionally you're looking at a similar reduction of volume. So in other words, the Payette Lake volume is about one-fifth or one-sixth that of Priest Lake. The volume we remove for the hatchery is about one-fifth or one-fourth of what we're talking about. So actually, Payette Lake maybe would not even be proportionally affected as much as Payette. Is that Priest would not be affected as
they
much.
They have affected more with the site than the Priest Lake.
Yes. Yes. Right. Yes.
Chip.
Oh, great. I'll take commission questions first. Thanks.
Do you guys have any historical data of what the fishery was like prior to the dam going in, say at the turn of the century? Was it a cold water fishery at that point?
So we have limited information on the quality of the Priest Lake fishery pre-installation of the outlet dam, even. So that was 1950, I believe, or right in that neighborhood. We have an anecdotal reports that suggest that it could have, that at times it was a very good cutthroat fishery. Now, was that a function of a large cutthroat population up and down the river? Was that a function of a large cutthroat trout population in the lake, many of which move down the river at certain times of the year? We've seen that in places like Henry's Lake. That I don't know. And that's one thing we're lacking, is good, solid data. It goes back to what Priest River was like before that outlet dam was constructed. The one difference the outlet dam makes is it impounds a shallow reach that is exposed to a north-south, it's a south-facing exposure, essentially. So it likely warms some. I do not know if it warms enough that it would have affected that red line to where it would have gone below the 19-degree sea line on that graph.
Okay, question. One other
question I had, Chip, is the obviously with the precaution that you're going to be completely respectful of the aesthetic issues in the shallow outlet area generally. How have these, are there the positive results from Sullivan Lake continuing with what they've done, or is it still too early to tell?
Well, with Sullivan, it may be too early to make a conclusion that it's a success forever, but the data that has come from Sullivan, the Sullivan Lake project has consistently demonstrated higher densities of trout in Sullivan Creek downstream than existed in there prior to the cold water augmentation there. So it's been, everything points to it working well and that it should work well into the future. There.
Besides the Sullivan Lake example, are there other places in the United States where this has been done, where the same similar goals and proving concept?
Yeah, so on a large scale or broader scale, essentially what you would be doing if you pulled water from the bottom of the lake, it's what you would call a tailwater fishery. In most cases, you think of a tailwater fishery, and when Joel was describing Hungry Horse Reservoir, and Bill asked the question, where's the water come from? Well, the water comes from the bottom, mostly from the bottom of the reservoir, and it comes out very cold. In fact, at Hungry Horse, it was so cold that the South Fork of the Flathead downstream from the dam was cold enough it was actually limiting growth of fish. And so that selective withdrawal was actually installed so they could find a temperature that was a little higher than the very cold water coming off the bottom of the lake to reduce growth rates. There are examples around the country of using cold water withdrawal to improve, in some cases, create trout fisheries that were never there. And the Green River is an example. The Bighorn River in Montana is an example. We have examples in Idaho where the best trout fishery in the South Fork Boise system is below Anderson Ranch Dam. On the Owyhee River is another example. And there are dozens and dozens of examples. And many of those are dams created on river systems creating reservoirs. And some of them are cold water withdrawal, similar to what we would be talking about with trees.
Okay,
Craig?
So you said that the cold water going into the river would affect it for 40 miles. How long is it from the outlet dam to the Pondre River? 44 miles. And would it, in order to try not to have stagnation in the lake with, or stagnation in that part of the river between the lake and the dam, is it possible to put the cold water in right where the water leaves the lake? Because it's only a mile from there to the dam. So you'd really just, would it just move it back to 39 miles from the dam?
Well, I'm not sure it's quite the one-to-one, because it is low velocity, shallow, and exposed to sunlight, it would probably warm up faster, so you'd probably lose a lot of your cold water benefit. We did ask them to kind of look at that, and there are systems in different parts of the country where they actually bubble water up from the hypolimnion by, they actually force the lake to do an artificial turnover to make the cold water spill over. And that, you can do that. I think you run the risk of more potential for some, at least localized, ecological problems with the, or limnological problems. So while I would love to do that way, it doesn't appear like it's that feasible to get the outcome you'd be looking for. Actually, I actually had a guy, I presented basically the same presentation to the Bonner County Natural Resources Committee a couple of weeks ago, and one of the guys asked about, well, couldn't you put, that's the term I'm looking for, but sort of like a heat exchange panel. Couldn't you put those along the bottom of the riverbed, the outlet bay? And I said, well, I'm not sure that that's going to look a whole lot better than the pipe. Maybe it would, but I don't know. I'm not a thermodynamics expert, but I'll ask the engineers. And the engineers kind of went, yeah, I don't think so. So, I'd love to find a nice, neat, tidy way to do that. And that idea did come up, but I don't think we found a way to do that.
And when you compare this to the Sullivan Lake project, where you call the outlet of the Sullivan Lake a creek versus the Priest River, mm-hmm. that's a wide meandering river, mm-hmm. that's not that deep in the middle of the summer. How do you get that comparison to?
Well, let me go back to the slides and I'll get that temperature graph up. So this is what the Portland State University folks, and they're the experts in this type of model. So I'm not going to wave a shiny laser and distract everybody, but you see these bumps are everywhere, right? They're consistent on each line. Those are where tributaries come in. So you see these little dips in temperature, and there's a brief cooling. But it's obviously in current condition, it's not enough to cool the river down to this dotted line. But if you start out colder, you get that benefit all the way to here. And with the black line, you actually stay basically to the mouth with colder water. And so that's this modeling is why we see the potential to create in the neighborhood 40 miles of good quality trout stream. And they, when they modeled this, they took into account the slow meandering, the depths, the channel shape, all of that in the river below the dam. So this is the best science available.
Okay, one last question. The 75%, how many CFS would that require?
So let's just say, it depends on what the outflow is in the summer, but if, let's say it was 100 CFS, that would be 75 CFS cold water and 25 CFS coming out of the dam. If it was 130, you just do the math, and 60 is the minimum, and of course we did get below that in 2015, but let's say it was 60 is the minimum, it would be 45. And You know, the other interesting thing about the water quality and the reach between the dam and the historic lake outlet, that mile or so, is in 2015, when there was quite a bit of controversy over whether maybe even shut the river off. I mean, I remember a pretty well-attended meeting at your guys' place up there. And we had folks saying, well, just shut the river off. And that question about water quality in that part of the channel didn't come up then. I mean, I'm sure it did in some people's minds. But I guess the point being is that obviously lake level is the driver here because that's the older of the minimum water rights. And that will be protected. And then, you know, ideally with the new dam and the ability and the work water resources has done, and I think you guys have heard about that, there will be the ability to avoid those kinds of controversies in the future where we can actually meet the 60 CFS minimum, but circling back around, that would be 45 CFS cold water if you use that model.
Okay, we have one more commissioner's question, and then we'll go to the public.
From the standpoint of, if you were in a situation where you were at that minimum street level, excuse me, not going lower than that, how would this help change the issue of water quality to the really extreme minimum
level? Sure. So the question is, if you're at, let's say we're in another 2015 type year where you're at minimum flow in the river and you're pulling 45 CFS of cold water and the channel is a little shallower, it's a little slower moving, I think you would see that this line here would push back and you would not likely see the benefits downstream further. The good news is downstream, because of tributary inputs, it starts to approximate that even under existing conditions in the last couple of miles. It's still higher. So I think in years where we have cool summers, where we have very protracted runoff, that period of time when you have that hot water bottleneck, very small. But in a low flow period, I would expect you would see that the lower part of the river would suffer some. And I'm speculating, but I think that they would agree with that. So. Ready here.
Yeah, why don't we go ahead and take questions from the public. And again, please speak up, and if you don't mind, identify yourself so we can keep a record of your comments. Thanks.
I'll start back.
Seldom being a success. I agree with you. I think it's way too early to tell. and you talked about the other successes of cold water bypasses. Some of us have been studying this, you know, for a long time now, since it's been brought up because it concerns us. There's a lot of negative results of cold water bypasses if you do a little homework. We've got Lake Shasta, where the hypomethane layer was depleted, even though all the studies before said it won't be. Would that do? Well, by $80 million later, they fixed that problem. There's you got Billy Deschutes, Billy Chinook River, Billy Chinook, and the Deschutes River. Sorry, I'm not a public speaker. You got the Detroit Lakes in, around Salem, Oregon. You've got a lot of lakes in Michigan and Wisconsin that have tried these cold water bypasses. Believe me, they are not all successful. If anyone wants any of this data, it's studies that are out there on the internet, I can get it for you. Second thing is, as far as the Portland State study, and in that chart actually right there, perfect for what I want to bring up, and that is, you're not talking about the margin of error on their studies, and even they have a margin of error of about a degree depending on which one you're looking at. And so I think we're really, really, really close. You're going to go spend millions of dollars, and we're just right on that line of whether it's actually going to make it at 19 degrees Celsius or not. I think that's cutting it a little thin myself. And it only really works, as far as I can see on that diagram, and the one I have printed out, at the 75% flow from the hypomethane water layer. If I can take 1 minute and just explain that. If the lake level is going to be the same amount of flow over the dam is going to be the same, but 75% of the water now coming through that dam is coming from the hypomethane layer out in the lake, what is happening to that water that used to flow through the dam that's sitting there in the upper part of the river? It's doing that. 25% is flowing out of, compared to what it used to be, of that water that sits there in the upper river. So how is that nothing stagnant? When you've got 75% coming from the middle of the lake or the deep part of the lake, it doesn't make any sense that there's not going to be some stagnation problem in the river to me when you're keeping everything else the same. The lake level's the same. The amount flowing over the dam is the same. The only difference is the input of what's going through the dam, and most of that's coming from the outer lake. The same amount of water is still going to be flowing into the river, and it's just going to sit there. Whereas now it flows through the river, it helps keep that water clean, helps clean water flow down through the river also. Can you explain it?
Well, so I think I addressed that a little bit earlier in that, well, I did. I said, I brought up that is a legitimate question. I said that. I just said that earlier. That's a legitimate question. And it's something we would have to look at. We are at step one of 50. It also begs the question of folks who were pressing to have no flow out of the lake in 2015 as to what about that water quality issue then. Why I say it was you, I'm saying that question came up. That came up with folks.
That was Elkins.
There's a bunch of folks.
That was Elkins who wanted to
share. There are a number of folks that have made those kinds of comments. I can't tell you right now off the top of my head if that's likely to affect that or not. In response to your questions about these other systems, yeah, you can look at some that were failures. Like Shasta is an impounded river. Lake Billy Chinook is not a natural lake. It's an impounded lake with a high volume coming in and a high volume going out. It's a different system. I get it. I said Sullivan's different. I just use that because it's close and folks might relate to it. I think Payette is probably the most similar one I can find. And I think Payette is a good example.
One thing I'd like to, or a couple things I'd like to clarify for everybody just before we go to the rest of the questions, and we're still good time-wise, so we've got plenty of time to get everyone's questions answered. But just so everyone's, I think most people are aware, but for those who are not, the lake level on Priest Lake is fixed by statute. In 1960, the lake level, the summer level, was essentially became, for lack of a better term, a statutory water right that guarantees the lake level. And so that's why when we met at Hills Resort in 2015 with the low water crisis on the Priest River, everyone became aware of that, but it is a prior right. You have to, we have to maintain the water of Priest Lake at its summer level, in basically for the full recreational season. There's a couple of other aspects here. One is that one very productive outcome of the meeting at Priest Lake, at the meeting at Hills in 2015, is that was the genesis of improving the dam in order to hold up to, I think, 6 inches of additional water in Priest Lake in a low water year like 2015. 2015 was a record low water year. 60 CFS, which is basically just a high pressure pipe coming out of the dam. So there was no flow coming out of Priest Lake in 2015. And the second is that nobody knows why the sort of green slime vegetation has crept onto the Priest River as badly as it has the last 30 years, but there's only one source, and unfortunately we're not able to promote the Lake Assist program. It's incredibly destructive for people of a Priest Lake to use lawn fertilizer, and yet they do it. It really should be not allowed on either Priest or Ponderay. It's not necessary. There's plenty of alternatives, but the reality is that all of the nitrogen from failed septics and all the nitrogen from fertilizer up at Priest Lake right now comes down the river. And it doesn't sink to the bottom, it comes right down the river. The new dam construction is in the planning stages now. You can get updates on the web or call the Department of Water Resources or check their website for updates. But I believe, Chip, and maybe you're more up to speed or not, but those projects are both well underway and probably into construction as early as, I don't know if this fall, but at least well into construction next winter.
Yeah.
But I do want everyone to understand that there is no guaranteed stream flow for the Priest River. The 60 CFS is absolutely the bare minimum, and I'm sure many of you remember the summer of 2015 where the river, particularly below the outlet, came pretty close to drying up. But this project, I just want everyone to be aware, is sort of going at the same pace as a project that has been approved, and I hope has the support of everyone up on the lake, which will enable in water crisis years for the lake to be held higher, which is a win-win for everybody, because it'll guarantee the statutory lake level and provide that extra 6 inches would provide probably enough stream flow to avoid serious crises like we had in 2015. So with that, why don't we have more questions from the public? And again, please identify yourself. Thanks.
Paul Sorakki. My question is, it's not feasible to bury the lake.
So that's a good question.
Repeat the question.
The question is it feasible to bury the pipe in the outlet corridor? When we sent that email back to the engineering firm, that's essentially what we're asking them to do, is examine whether that is a feasible alternative. I don't know if it is or not, and if it's not, for what reasons, why not? So it's just one thing that's worth looking at. Yes?
With the siphon, will it run the year round, or are you only going to use it during the warm water months?
Well, so I'll elaborate a little more on the siphon, which was how we kind of, the initial idea was, could we do this with a siphon? But the engineers have told us that because of friction coefficients and all kinds of stuff, that in order to actually run a siphon, you would have to run the pipe down the river corridor below the dam some distance in order to maintain that. So we're probably not going to do that because we lose some of the value of having cold water habitat below the dam by doing that. Maybe more to the point of your question, which was, would we run this year round? whatever it is, if we got one. There could be some benefits from doing that, in that when you, these, you know, if you take a classic tailwater fishery that's functioning to create a great trout habitat, and I'll use the Bighorn River in Montana as an example. Because that temperature comes out and it's a fairly constant temperature year-round, those trout are growing year-round. They're not having peaks and valleys in their growth. So there could be a reason for doing that. What we're really interested in is to get through this hot water bottleneck and finding a route forward to do that. And so whether we did something like that year-round would depend on a whole lot of things. It would depend on what would be the limnological effects of the lake if you did it year-round. What would be the cost of doing it? And if you're using pumping, would that change? That would change, obviously. But at its core, this is about trying to fix a bottleneck. And I think if some opportunity presented itself to increase growth rates and increase production of fish, I think we'd look at that, but there's a whole lot of questions we have to ask about that. It's a good question, thank you. Yes?
Axel Heiser. I hear about the river, but I'm curious, has anything been looked at since you're drawing from a fixed position in the lake itself? And I don't know what the temperature variations are at different depths of the lake, but at 60 CFS, you're drawing about 3,600 to 4,000 gallons a minute, if I'm doing the math right.
Mm-hmm.
Does that do anything as far as a continued use of changing the temperature in the lake itself, or all of a sudden you're creating an ecosystem that's changing in the lake by drawing cold water out and allowing the hot water to continue to generate?
So the question is, would drawing from a fixed position in the lake over time affect the ecology of that portion of the lake? Is that accurate? Yeah. So we think the answer to that is no, because it's such a tiny proportion of that. That is one of the steps we would have to address in order to take something further. I don't want to spend money on a limnology study, however, if the engineering says we're not going anywhere, right? So before we get to that step, I would like to understand, we would like to understand, is there a route forward from an engineering standpoint? And if that's the case, then the next steps you would look at would be, what does that yellow dot mean in terms of how the lake responds? And I said, in Payette Lake, it doesn't affect it. And proportionally, we're talking about a very similar type of situation. Doesn't mean it will respond the same way. There's indications that it would not be a major effect. Won't know for certain without further study, though. Bill.
My name is Bill Love. I'm the president of the Panhandle Chapter of Trout Unlimited. Nationally, Trout Unlimited has over 400 chapters and several hundred thousand members. Locally, the Panhandle Chapter has about 300 members, and we definitely support pursuing this concept and exploring the opportunity. Now, as a way of disclosure, I also want to point out that the Panhandle Chapter of Trout Unlimited was involved with the negotiations for the Clark Fork Settlement Agreement a little over 20 years ago, where Avista Corporation was pursuing relicensing for their Cabin Gorge and Nice and Rapids stands. And as a signer of that Clark Fork Settlement Agreement, then that gives us a seat at the table with various committees that review proposals and evaluate the proposals and make recommendations for Avista mitigation funding. And so, as such, then we certainly supported this study that Chip was just presenting on. And so, we are definitely in favor of pursuing this. There's been some comments made about the historic fishery in Priest River, and obviously, one factor that contributed to that was in 1950 the construction of Valley Dam. At that time, that also meant the end of log rise on Priest River. The log rise started early in the early 1900s, originally by Humber company and later by Diamond and another timber companies. And those log rights covered a period of roughly 50 years, and there's still some legacy effects and negative impacts from those log rights. And so, you know, that also has contributed to the current fish habitat in Breach River. As Chip pointed out, one of the main driving factors is Breach River and many of its tributaries are listed as water quality limited, and the Idaho Department of Environmental Quality has developed TMDL plans to help improve the water quality on those. So I know others want to speak, and so I'll yield the floor back to you, Jim.
Yes.
My name is Lance. I'm proud of Chris Lake. In this concept of yours, I see no good coming from it for the fisheries, Chris Lake, which is at present is under stress. It adds nothing. It takes away. It's going to create more problems, and I think we'll see a scenario where we have unintended consequences. Perhaps the level of the lake is low when the COVID is gone. Can we lose that? For sure. There's a lot of, this is fraught with, the scheme is fraught with all kinds of unintended consequences. Why do you have to screw around with something that's already in trouble?
Well, it won't affect lake levels.
I'm not so sure.
Well, it can.
You have a certain amount of input into that lake, and if you're going to maintain the spill that's there, where are you going to manufacture this water?
You don't change the outflow of water. All you change is where it comes from. And that's
take water from the bottom of the bucket, it affects the top of the bucket.
Only if you take it out faster than it's coming in. If you don't take it out faster than it's coming in, it'll stay the same. And that's essentially what the dam has done for almost 70 years now. So it won't change the lake level. And as far as how it might affect the fishery, now the example of Lake Billy Chinook was brought up as an example of where it hasn't worked downstream, but Lake Billy Chinook is one of the strongest bull trout populations in the western United States. It's an outstanding population of bull trout in Lake Billy Chinook. That's probably the most water quality sensitive fish that we have in the Northwest.
So you're saying our bull trout will increase the lake?
I didn't say that. I just said that water quality, I don't think that it's a foregone conclusion that water quality would suffer. In fact, I think that the evidence suggests otherwise. I'm not saying it's confirmed, and that's why you would want to take a harder look at it if we progress forward with this. Yes?
My name is Betty Gardner. I live on the Priest River. I have for over 40 years. I have watched it decline rapidly. There are no trout. There are very few. We snorkel, we kayak, we take our kids and grandkids. We watch the green snot that Ford referred to. I have a photograph where I have holding a rock. I pulled up out ankle deep water, and there's green mucus about this long. There are no crayfish anymore. There are now invasive green bullfrogs, which have eaten all of the native little brown frogs. They're gone. We have pond lilies growing in the river now. We have tons of smallmouth bass, warm water fish, that weren't there 40 years ago. My dad used to come in the 80s and catch his limit of trout every day. By the time he went home in 2 weeks, we had enough trout to feed us until he came back the following year. By the 90s, he was getting one or two trout a day. By the 2000s, he was getting one or two a week. And in the last few years of his life, he could go down there for 6 hours with his lunch and come back up with nothing. And if you, I love Priest Lake. I went out on Priest Lake to 14 different sites over the last few years testing with Selkirk Conservation Alliance. It is a jewel. It's one, and like the upper thoroughfare, one of the most spectacular places in the world. I don't want to hurt the lake, because if the lake is harmed, it will only get worse for the river and everything below it. But Priest River was dead. designated impaired by the Department of Environmental Quality in 2006, and it filed a report in 2007, and according to the Clean Water Act of 1972, by law, it's supposed to put in a mitigation plan to improve an impaired waterway whenever possible. In that 2007, Glenn Rothrock from the DEQ told me, the only way the Peace River has a chance is if you get people to raise cane, because we are underfunded, overworked, and if you have one or two people on the river saying something's wrong, and you have a million people a year visiting Priest Lake, the focus is going to be on keeping Priest Lake wonderful and beautiful, and what happens below is not such a big deal because all you have are a few poor farmers and people living on a 40-mile stretch, so he said, good luck with that. So I come to these meetings and I get riled up and I say, please, we don't want to harm the lake. We want it to be beautiful and wonderful. We want your grandkids to be able to sit on the lake and not have to walk through 6 inches of green and brown slime. My grandbabies go down to the river to play now and I have to brush away the muck. I'd like to know if you'd like to put your two-year-old grandson or granddaughter, if the bays at Priest Lake start looking like the edges of the river in Priest River, you will then say, oh, maybe we should have done something, because we're all connected. There's no us or them, folks.
Okay, I think there's a few more questions. Yeah, you.
Teresa Morgan. So one of my concerns is that if you change the temperature balance in the lake, it will just eventually pass on the problems to the river and actually run the risk of harming the cold water species that are already in the lake. And they're already obviously impaired as it is. So it would seem to me that if we looked at the causes that are actually warming the lake, such as the tributaries of the river around the lake, not to mention the, you know, the herbicides and pesticides that are going on, but try to look at a more holistic look at why the lake is warming and passing on the problem to the river, then maybe you won't need these fixes like this. The other thing I did was attend the USGS presentation on their establishing the NDLs for Peace River. It was a great study, and I'm going to keep doing that. I didn't see the slide in your show, but it also showed these drops in temperature along the river. Those, they said, were caused primarily from artesian sources. So I wonder if you looked at tapping into an artesian system so that you wouldn't need a pump for cold water source for the rest of the river.
So I don't think we've looked at an artesian source per se, but the whole groundwater pumping idea was a, we asked them to look at the potential for using water not from the hypolimnium to improve conditions in the river. So that's what the groundwater pumping is. And groundwater pumping could be from 10 feet or it could be from 100 feet, but it would depend on the aquifer and it would depend on a lot of things. And we don't know the answers to that right now.
Well, there's a lot of artesian sources where you can have fish under pressure.
Yeah. Seems like you had another question in that, and I maybe missed it, but I guess maybe we'll get back to it. Let me go here first. Yeah.
First question. The 44 miles that would be helped out, so what was the CO on that the flow rate out of that site? What were you expecting?
Well, again, so that when temperatures are most likely the limiting factor is late summer, low flow, hot air temperatures. Typically in August, those flows are somewhere between the 60 CFS minimum and 120. So if you take 75% of that, that would be that black line that was on that graph. If you took 50% of that.
So at 120 flow rate, you're taking 75% of that, that gets you 44 miles?
Yes.
Okay. Second question. you actually think that's not going to be impacted if you decrease that and you take 75% 60, you don't think that temperature in that area is going to go up because serious ramifications in that location?
I didn't say that it wouldn't. So we would not, I said we would have to.
People that actually live on that.
We would have to take a look at that.
Yeah. Well, we can tell you from, we see that temperature rising there as it sits today.
And the question is, would it affect the water quality? And that's the question.
And if I'm going to say that most people would be
in the opposite. Well, not good enough. I'd say we're going to look at what.
That it actually does affect.
We will look at what.
Do you shut off the cold water to the river, or do you fix the problem upstream? And so these are major concerns of people that actually invest in money in places in that location based on a set of parameters. And now we've got a bunch of people who want to go around and change because and financially impact these problems. Seriously.
Right.
A lot of cash. And the picture you took up there, it's not our place.
I will take it, and that was through the courtesy of photo ones. Not my photo. That was one that was sent to me.
Just a question. I'm sorry. It's kind of a little bit off top, but it still affects the lower river. And that is, in the fall, when you open up the gates, you basically open them up, and your river rises like a foot, not a foot, we'll say 6 inches a night. That's just like a flooding thing happened. Flush, and you're pushing a lot of stuff down the river at one time. And normally it doesn't happen that way in the normal situation. Have you ever considered slowing it down so you don't get that toilet bowl flush?
Yeah, so we don't. The only thing we do and have tied to how that is operated is in the past we had asked Water Resources to time it so that the low pool was established before shoreline coping spawning occurred. We never said, you know, do it in a day, do it in a week, do it in a month. It's a water resources decision process, and I guess I can't really answer that question well for you.
That's fine.
Yeah. Yes.
Ann Chamberlain, I'm a summer cabin owner at Grease Lake, and I've been very concerned about what it would do to the water quality of the lake. And what I was reading on the internet said that quite often you don't see the effects for 10 years or so. And so I hope in all of your feasibility studies that you're really looking into how other lakes have responded. And my next question is, are you planning any meetings of this sort in the summer when more of the summer people are?
So, yes. Second part of your question, as we get to what we would call the final alternatives assessment, then we will come back out. Part of my concern with having a draft out in the public hands is that folks would look at it and go, oh my God, they've made decisions, I can't live with these. We haven't. And, you know, I'm pretty disappointed that despite the message I gave with when I provided the draft to someone, that we have already made it clear, abundantly clear, that a pipe down the middle of the, sitting above the bed of the outlet is not acceptable, and yet I'm still getting emails about what's a pipe going to look like in this section. It's not going to look like anything because it won't be there.
But they're going to bury the pipe.
I don't know yet. I don't know that we'll use that route. One of the routes would pump water and follow existing water lines around along road corridors and come around. It's ideas right now. It's not, there's nothing formal. And as far as, now I forgot the other part of your question, so can you tell me what it was again?
Well, I was worried about the impact of the water quality.
Right, okay, so, you know, I guess the reason I put the Payette Lake example up there, I realize it's not a one-to-one or an exact replica of Priest Lake, but Payette's very similar. When Payette Lake has had water quality problems that were identified, It was right after the big fires in the mid-1990s. And it had nothing to do with that. That pipe that was providing water to the hatchery has been in there since 1979. That's not caused the water quality problem. Not saying it's absolutely the same thing, but I guess what I'm saying is it gives us an idea that it's over a fairly long time period that you can do that kind of thing and not see a negative impact on a lake, an oligotrophic or clean, clear lake like Payette or Priest. That's the reason I put that out there. It doesn't mean it's exactly the same, but it does mean that it is possible. Yeah.
Well, I was very impressed with the survey system that they did about the fish. And would you do that type of a survey to see what public support would be if you got to that point?
So, yeah, and I know this is, I want to say, the fourth or fifth time we've presented something on this concept since 2014, just in this meeting. We just haven't had a whole lot to go with. So when we get an analysis, what we call the alternatives analysis, completed, hopefully by the end of spring, we'll be in a position to go out and say, here are the alternatives that the engineers tell us are possible. But what we still all, even if one of those or two of those look really good, folks are going to have to understand that there's still a whole lot of steps you have to go through to implement something, because we still have to look at the limnology questions or the water quality questions. That's a biggie, and then even if you got to the stage where we were going to look for it, we have to get funding. We have to go through the permitting. So there's a lot of work that has to happen, and there's a lot of opportunity to comment along the way, and we've been trying to do that. I know people have been a little upset that, well, gee, you didn't come. We can't dig up the Priest Lake at the invitation of the Priest Lake Sportsmen's Association last spring, and we had a pretty well-attended meeting there. There's a lot of questions of why didn't you come talk to us this summer? And the answer was, we don't have a whole lot more to discuss than we do. Now we are starting to get that information. And if we get that information, we'll bring that up to Priest Lake and places like this. Yes?
Phyllis Cardos, your very first statement almost when you got up to talk had to do with water being too hot year-round in aquatic life. And instead of trying to solve that solution, you know why that's occurred? Oftentimes those things occur because of man-caused poor logging practices or over-allocation of the resource. So I'm just wondering, have you looked into what is causing that? And how long, when did it become first noticed? And what was being done?
Well, so from a fishery standpoint, the first somewhat comprehensive study was the one I referred to in 1974. The lake, because it has a big surface area, because it stratifies in the summer, so the warmer water is on the top, and it's exposed to solar radiation, depending on inflow and outflow, that will, and air temperature, that will drive water temperature. Maybe the Priest River below the dam always periodically had a temperature challenge late in the summer. And really, it affects the year-round survival of trout, but it's only because of a short window of time when those temperatures are really hot. So, are there other things that could affect that? So, you might, you know, there's concern about, well, what about historic logging practices, for instance. So yeah, as Bill mentioned, they used to drive logs down the river. They probably, you can see stumps in the riparian area, so they log big cedars. But larger rivers are less dependent on shade than they are on what the inputs are. The major input, of course, is the outlet from the lake, and then, of course, as you get tributary inflow or it's artesian to some point, you see little cool spots pop up. So I think the system is inherently on the ragged edge anyway. Whether it's a whole lot worse than it historically was, you know, 1900s, I can't tell you. I can tell you you look at temperature data for this region, in the early part of this 20th century, it was generally cooler back then than it is now. Not that you didn't have hot summer. Certainly, and actually, if you look at the climate models, they put the Priest River system out of it because of its north-south exposure and zonation.
We have about 5 minutes left for questions, so two or three more questions, then we will have to wrap up.
Jim?
Increasing the population of trout, would that provide another conduit for the walleye and other predator species like that to develop into the lake?
Well, there's currently a non-game fish component. It's just this palatable walleye in there. Cooling the river off would make it less suitable walleye habitat than trout habitat. So I'm not that concerned about that aspect there. Walleye do pretty well in cooler waters. They don't tend to invade cold water streams. They tend to invade cool water systems. I can't tell you for certain what would happen. I do think that we're probably going to see walleye coming up in existing conditions. And I do think there's potential for them to get into the lake when the dam boards are out. Yes? Oh, sorry, I'm getting that.
I have a question about the process. Mm-hmm. You put a slide up there that had the last phase was funding and permitting. The first dot was only if all of the above are acceptable. Mm-hmm. Can you design, can you talk about who determines what is it, if it's acceptable, and what is considered acceptable?
Well, I mean, that's, with a process like this, it's similar to what Andy described for the fishery, is you have to weigh a whole bunch of things. It's not like there's a black and white answer to that question. But if we have adequate public support, we have funding, and we have strong reason to believe we're not going to have a negative impact on a lake, we will have a positive impact on the river. Somewhere in there is where you would just describe it as acceptable. If you didn't meet those things, then somewhere in there you would say that's not acceptable. And I can't give you a hard answer where that is because it's not the sort of thing that you have some bar, that you have some metrics that you can magically measure for that. But it is public process similar to what we went through on the fishery on Priest Lake, which there's a lot of people that don't like the outcome of where we went with Priest Lake. As Andy pointed out, about half the folks don't really agree with that. We didn't have the funding to change it. We didn't have strong public support to change it, so we didn't. So that's kind of the process we go through. And I don't know if that answers your question on that, but that's a good
Chip, excuse me, but I think we're sort of at our end point here. So thank you very much for the presentation. I wanted to give all of you some additional information. We'll probably be scheduling another Lakes Commission meeting in June. I don't know if Chip will have an update then, but I'm sure we'll have updates on the other Priest Lake projects, the thoroughfare and the dam. Will be updated at the June meeting, so you look for notices of that. It will probably be in Sandpoint, but we have been having location issues there, so who knows, it may be back here or at the Beardmore, but one way or the other, we'll be having a meeting in June and invite you all to attend. And if the lake isn't full by the date of our meeting, I'm sure the Corps won't have quite as easy a time as they had this today with the questions and answers, but we'll see everybody in June, and thank you all for being here today. Thank you.